Call the order of the 67th meeting of the New Jersey Highlands Water Protection and Planning Council. My name is John Weingard. I live in Surgeonsville in Hunterdon County.
Jack Schreier, duly elected public member, freeholder from Morris County.
Janice Kovac, Tama Clinton, Hunterdon County.
Scott Weinack, public member of Morristown.
Tim Dillingham, public member.
Tracy Carluccio, public representative from Hunterdon County. Tahisha Wade, Passaic County, freeholder.
Mimi Les, Persipony in Morris County.
And on the telephone?
Debbie Pascarelli, Greenwich Township, Warren County.
Glenn Vetrano, Sussex County, freeholder.
We have a quorum. This meeting was advertised in accordance with the Open Public Meetings Act. And will who wish please rise to the Pledge of Allegiance.
Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Do we have minutes from last week?
I'll move the minutes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Second.
Any discussion on the minutes? These are from our meeting way back last week. Any comments? Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions?
Abstain.
Okay. Minutes carried. I have three things to mention. In our packets this morning, and I don't know if people on the phone got it or not, is a letter from Kurt Alstad to us, who was unable to be here today, but wrote about the agricultural cluster provisions. So it's a letter dated today. Did the members on the phone get this?
No? I just checked my email a bit ago. I've not seen it.
Glenn and Debbie get Kurt's comments.
I can put it together.
Okay. We'll send it.
Okay. All right. We have no committees meeting today and no committee reports from last week, but we do have the TDR committee is scheduled to meet in 2 weeks on May 15th after the council meeting. So May 15th is the next council meeting, which is 10 o'clock, and the TDR committee will be meeting right after that. And the council members, our financial disclosure reports are due in 2 weeks on May 15th. And also, for those who have not had the pleasure of ethics training yet, we have to have completed that by May 15th. And anyone needing any help with either of those things can talk to Kim. I had to report to the council members. Any minister report?
I just have a quick question.
Yeah.
The conversation we had at the last council meeting, I know we're not, this isn't.
He's away.
I know it's not for, we're not going to be discussing it today, but I just wanted to clarify. When we talked about the water quality management plans and the consistency, what we were talking about was for non-conforming towns. Towns that decide to opt into the regional master plan will have to meet the requirements that are currently stated in the plan. This isn't replacing what was in the plan.
You're absolutely correct. Conforming municipalities will be held to nitrate thresholds that are in the regional master plan.
Okay. Thank you.
Go to the director's report.
Well, it's all the week since I last reported out to you. And I think you probably know what we've been doing because you've got your packets. We've updated some of the information in your packets today. You got it and we sent it out to council members as well. We've had a couple of meetings. The regularly scheduled county planners meeting has been held. There was a meeting with Somerset County on their water quality management plan. That was with Somerset County, the affected municipalities from the Highlands region, the Department of Environmental Protection, and ourselves. And that's really all I have until we get into the discussion on the regional master plan.
Okay. Well, given that we have no committee reports and we have no local grants to consider today, right?
That's correct.
Okay. We'll now get into the discussion of the regional master plan.
Okay. What we'll try to do is, as we go through this, is just guide you through the documents that I'm talking about as well as best we can. First matter we're going to discuss this morning is water availability, water deficit policy options, and that is the paper that's heading water deficit policy options. Now, remembering again that what we're doing is we're looking at what was in the 2007 draft final, and in response to comments received both from both yourselves and from the public, staff has worked on the issue in response to those comments and offers some modifications and changes for your consideration today. The comments focused from the public focused primarily on deficit mitigation policies, requirements and procedures. There were no issues raised regarding changing thresholds or the calculation methodology for the net water availability. So how we got to, you know, those areas in deficit, no questions about that. The questions really, though, were on deficit mitigation policies. The water use and conservation management plans in the 2007 draft, we call them water management plans, really looking to what our mission is, talking about water use and primarily conservation, because it's one of the overriding goals from the Act. So those plans, that's what we're referring to them as, the water use and conservation management plans. Three fundamental issues were raised by these comments and council discussions, and they are conditional water availability in deficit areas, the certainty of achieving mitigation that addresses those deficit issues, and what happens if mitigation is not feasible. So looking first at the sub-watersheds that according to our calculations based on low flow margins, 114 of the 183 sub-watersheds have deficits. And here you see on this slide the million gallons a day deficit numbers and the HUCs that are affected. So you can see that many of them, those first 22, are marginally in deficit, and then you get all the way up to the final 17 that have deficits somewhere between 1 million to 7 million gallons per day. The highest deficits are from depleted uses. But nearly half of the HUCs have less than 250,000 gallons per day. That's the deficit. We tried to look at this and give some sort of understanding of what is the range of homes, so in residential use, if you compare it to their conditional availability. We've limited 1% or 2% of total water availability in aggregate, not per project. So it's important to recognize the threshold there, that in these areas of deficit, there's some opportunity, but when they reach the threshold, that's it. There's no more building until there's a water use and conservation management plan in place. So it's not as if you can just keep on working and building. You reach the threshold, it's done. You have to start the planning. The object of the exercise here, from our perspective, is to get towns to do these water use and conservation management plans. That's what we want to see. We want to see planning, how you will reduce these deficits over time, and good planning that would dictate as well that where there is availability, conditional availability, that the town would dictate where that goes if they do these plans. Nearly all the sub-watersheds, less than 25,000 gallons per day of conditional water availability. And here you see on this slide the gallonage in the first part of the table, then the number of homes that could be built with that kind of gallonage if it was consumptive use, and then if it was depleted use, and then finally the number of HUCs. Now, the options for improving policy mitigation thresholds. What we've done is, in the 2007 draft, what we had said was 125% mitigation would be required in order to have that conditional water use availability. What we've done now in terms of strengthening this is to scale the mitigation thresholds for project reviews prior to that water use and conservation management plan approval based on the size of deficit and the use that's proposed. Important to realise again that once you've done that plan, this policy goes away. because the plan dictates what happens then with any conditional, not the policies we're showing you today. The larger deficits are related to highly developed areas with more opportunities for water conservation. Highly developed areas have more opportunities for stormwater retrofits of older buildings. Land values are also higher, which drives higher value development that can better afford mitigation. And scaled mitigation thresholds reduces deficits more where deficits are higher. So what we propose here is that there are different thresholds in place. So depending on the amount of water, conditional water that's used, the range goes from 125% mitigation all the way up to 200%. The other issue we looked at is in the 2007 draft, we treated all deficits equal. But there's a very great difference between minor areas that are just barely in deficit versus these ones that are, for example, to 1 million to 7 million gallons per day. So where you see the red numbers there, the recommendation is that mitigation will be required prior to construction. So that's where the highest combination of deficits and proposed uses, that we could have that mitigation prior to construction. And it would be easier to do, and I rely on this, on the staff for this, but Dan has done a lot of work on this, it would be easier to do in those areas as well, so that they could do that mitigation in advance of achieving the project. And I did want to bring to your attention... Jim, I'm sorry, could you grab me that paper you wrote up for me?
Sure.
On runoff, thank you. I apologize, I meant to bring it with me. What I wanted to do is talk to you about... thank you. Jimmy Abbott, thanks. Because of the work we've done with the Heritage Village 55 project, Randolph sent some information in to us on what they've done in their town to reduce their deficits. And I don't offer it today as any in terms of working on that particular project, but in terms of seeing how you can actually reduce the deficit, we have something from Randolph which I think would help you in your consideration. Randolph Township submitted materials to us to demonstrate mitigation requirements and how you can satisfy them. They did three separate action items in their town to reduce water demand. One, they instituted revised water use fees to place significant cost burdens on large water consumers. Secondly, they established an ordinance which required odd, even lawn watering during summer months. And thirdly, they did a system-wide mapping and leak detection survey of the water distribution system. And on that final project, they reported out the results of that leak detection survey. Over a two-year period, Randolph Township estimated that repair work associated with the study saved the township approximately 440,000 gallons per day, far exceeding the 9,400 that we were looking for mitigation on that particular project. Based on the contractor's report, the township will also realize annual savings of $280,000 associated with the unmetered losses, while only spending $24,000 for the survey. And that equates to a benefit-to-cost ratio of 12 to 1. So we thought this was important because we had the information in and we thought it showed how mitigation can work.
John, may I ask a question?
Let's wait until the report's finished, which I think is
okay.
We're almost there.
The certainty of mitigation in recharge areas. Again, this was the questions that were raised about certainty of mitigation. Recharge technology that we're proposing here are the same best management practices as already used by NJDEP, US EPA, and many states in their rules and guidance manuals. So they are tried and tested technologies. Issues regarding recharge benefits. Recharge in this case is happening relatively fast, days to weeks, not years to decades. This is completely different to the issue of travel time from point of recharge to point of discharge. In other words, when the water goes into the system, down into the aquifers and back out in streams. That certainly is something that takes, I don't know, infinitely longer compared to the recharge in other areas. Not all recharge gets to aquifers, but does get to streams. Uncertainty regarding flow path led to constraints on the conditional water availability. Technology well proven, used in safe drinking water and US EPA water sense programs. The long-term benefits expected from many techniques, the object here is to overshoot the objective to ensure sufficient results, and monitoring through billing records of water purveyors, things like that. When it comes to residential appliances and fixtures, once you put those low-flow appliances and fixtures in place in houses, they stay. It's not as if, you know, when the new owner comes in and rips them out and puts in less conservative fixtures. In industries and water-using commercial facilities, there are benefits, such as we saw in that Randolph case, there are benefits for them to do this, use conservation methods and techniques. Lawn irrigation, we can use things like that as well. Now, that does need some monitoring. And water loss reductions, again, similar to the Randolph example. Agricultural irrigation also provides long-term benefits, and we would be requiring monitoring results as condition of approval, project-specific and in plans. That's water use and conservation management plans. The certainty of mitigation. Historically, when you look at droughts and issues of that nature, they've been responded to through new water supplies, such as reservoirs. But what we're doing here in this regional master plan is fundamentally different to that. Nearly half of the deficits we're looking at are less than 0.25 million gallons per day, which is small relative to the deficits triggering new supplies. 17 deficits do exceed the 1 million gallons per day. Conditional availability of 0.025 million gallons a day is minimal, and the deficit reduction will require concerted efforts, possibly infrastructure in those cases. Some deficits can be addressed in combination through more regional planning. The responses will vary by deficit, area, and available infrastructure. Where the deficit is minimal, conditional availability and mitigation may erase the deficits. I'm getting then to where mitigation is infeasible. So, for example, the project may not be able to meet the requirements. Conditional water availability may be completely used. In those cases, the response has to be the project cannot be approved as proposed and either has to be revised to meet the requirements or abandoned. In other words, it's turned down. The alternative is to participate in the Water Use and Conservation Management Plan development to determine if a collaborative solution is possible. I also want to remind you that when you looked at those tables, we're talking about one issue here, the deficits, but these projects would also be held to other regional master plan goals, policies, and objectives. So there are other limiting factors that may come into play. So just because you're approaching it from conditional water availability, you still have to meet critical habitat standards. You still have to meet all the different resource protections. So I want to put that just to make sure it's in context, that nothing is examined entirely on its own. All the goals, policies, and objectives of the plan are applied to each of these kind of applications. That's the end of this one.
Can you just summarize one thing? The difference from what you're proposing now as opposed to what was in the November 2007 plan is what?
The scaled mitigation approach is different when we talk about going from, in some cases, the work has to be done in advance. Also, not just 125%, it goes up to 200% mitigation, dependent on the water use and the scale of the deficit. So that's a much more structured approach. And I think there's a lot of clarification here as well.
Debbie?
I had a question about the figures that were being discussed with regard to the water survey, the costs associated with that study. And I believe, Eileen, you said 28,000 or something?
The study in Randolph.
Yes. What I said, Debbie, was that based on the contractor's report, the township realizes annual savings of 280,000, and their cost for the survey was 24,000.
Okay. My question was, the cost of the survey was 24,000. Did that survey indicate areas where there needed to be repairs to the system?
Yes, the survey...
And what are the costs of the repairs associated with that? Because the figures presented don't appear to give the whole picture. And the reason I bring that up is we can do analyses like this and point to very sound reasons why things should be done. But in reality, sometimes the costs are astronomical and a municipality will leave either a sewer system or a water supply system that's in trouble in place because they're simply not going to fund it. So I was just curious what figures we had on what kind of repairs that were needed, what cost estimates, and if they actually completed any.
Well, this analysis was not done by our staff. This was actually provided by Randolph. So they were the ones who said that this was the cost associated with the project. We haven't done an analysis, Debbie, but what we did is we took their figures because they offered this to us in
right.
response to the Heritage 55. I would hope that if they felt the costs were way more, they would have shown that because it would behoove them to say, you know, what it cost them.
Okay, so are there figures in there for remediation costs?
No.
It sounds like no.
Unless it's included in that $24,000, which I can't answer to. These are the figures they gave us for cost versus benefit.
Okay, and I understand because I'm having a little trouble hearing, and I don't want to walk away from this misunderstanding. Those are the survey costs. They are not the repair. To the best of our knowledge, what they supplied did not include any repair costs.
And I don't actually know that. They just basically gave us that was their cost, but I can't answer that. We'll obviously find out more from them.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, well, thanks for the presentation. Comments?
Yeah, I have a couple of questions. I continue to have concerns. You know, we still are allowing new development in water deficit areas. I see that, you are trying to, with the stepped approach and having more specifics in regard to the mitigation, trying to put, a little more depth to the program. But I still have concerns, and maybe you can help me figure this out, on how we would actually measure in particularly in an instance where you have to meet prior implementation. Like, how would we actually measure? Would it be a calculation done by an engineer on a piece of paper, or will there actually be measurements done in terms of water that's recharged now available?
I think that some of the answers to this are in the next part of the PowerPoint when we get into the implementation process, the program, the GPO program suggestions, and then the implementation process.
Okay, yes, we can hold that till next, but let me know a couple other questions if we're going to talk about it later, that's fine. This also would apply to projects that use individual wells as well, right? Not just projects that use infrastructure that piped water.
The remediation or the project?
The project.
It would apply to non-exempt projects.
Okay.
So if you're really talking about an individual well on an individual home, if they're exempt from the Highlands Act, we would not see it.
Well, let's say it's a minor subdivision. It's a couple of houses. But they're individual wells. They're not served by a community system. It does apply there, too.
Yes.
So it seems to me very difficult. But how are we going to require individual wells are we going to measure how much water is actually being used through discharges to septic systems and how much water they're using in their homes through their conservation measures? I mean, are we going to walk into people's homes and make sure meters are in place? I mean, right now, people don't have to have meters on their individual home wells, and they don't typically measure flows to septic systems either. Well, how can we accomplish this on a small scale?
I think through deed restrictions, and I've seen it done on projects where they're coming in and looking at water issues on a project where you have sort of controls on what they're allowed to do in terms of swimming pools not being allowed, whether it's irrigation of their lawns, how that's handled, issues like that through deed restrictions. That's what I'd imagine.
The other issue is we should recognize that the assumptions with regard to consumptive use are all based on a nominal amount of water per household and an expectation as to what that household does with that water. So all of our consumptive use calculations are on that basis. They're based on X hundred gallons per day
right.
per household. And so with a domestic well and a septic system, the way the equation works out is that over the course of the summertime period, which is the critical period, 29% of that use is lost to evaporation. Mm-hmm. Fine. We're not going to be metering their water use or the flow into the septic system. We're simply using that as the basis, and they would have to mitigate that through, in case of a small subdivision dealing with domestic wells and septic systems, the easiest way of mitigating that consumptive use is through enhanced recharge, better rooftop recharge, things of that nature.
I mean, I certainly believe in recharge and in infiltration through stormwater systems, but we're supposed to be doing that anyway. We're talking about something above and beyond what we're supposed to be doing already
for yes.
stormwater regulations. I have real concerns
about that. This is beyond the DEP requirements for stormwater, so you have to meet that first, and then this would be in addition to that.
Mm-hmm. Right. And until we get maybe in the next PowerPoint, I just have real concerns about how practically this is going to apply, particularly when you're not having an infrastructure that you can measure. And I think it's all very theoretical and makes me very uncomfortable. Another question about, I was thinking as I was reading this about drought, and, you know, we talk about normal, you know, we're talking about the three-month averages and we're talking about, you know, normal times, but in drought, that's usually, you know, when you get into the drought warning and then the drought emergency, declarations by DEP, that's when you go into the measures of cutting back on lawn watering, the kind of things that Randolph was talking about. But now we're talking about doing that during, you know, regular times in order to reduce the use and in order to use areas that have water deficits. What about when we get into the crunch times with drought, and have we done any planning, considering that circumstance?
If I may, the odd-even watering restrictions that Randolph uses, those are not intended to actually decrease the total use in a summer. They're used to decrease the peak daily use. Mm-hmm. And so I certainly would not consider odd-even watering as a method of actually reducing total water use. You reduce total water use for your lawn irrigation through irrigation systems that have soil moisture sensors and things of that nature. And then during a drought period, you just shut them down. So that's really the difference between normal and drought. But not even the evidence that we have from other places in the state that have tried it is that you reduce the peak daily water use, but not necessarily the monthly use for irrigation.
So we can't disagree with that.
Well,
I mean, you know, precipity implemented odd even many years ago because we were really having a water availability problem. And we did experience significant savings. You've got to monitor it. You've got to enforce it.
Mm-hmm.
But you can save an awful lot.
And that's where we keep getting back to those water use and conservation management plans, because that's where we really, that's the goal here, is to get to those. And that's how you do that comprehensively, working with towns and take care of the monitoring end as well.
Yeah, because there's South Jersey studies where it shows the opposite, but if it works, it works. That's great.
If you don't enforce it, you don't go around and knock on doors at 2 o'clock in the morning and tell people to stop watering the driveways.
I won't volunteer for that.
Now, just one other. I'm still there. What do you mean by the collaborative solutions in that last point there?
Across watersheds, even across municipalities, and we're working with Town of Clinton at the moment on a water use and conservation management plan, and there's been interaction as well with the municipalities around them by need, because you have to recognise the interconnections there. So there are opportunities collaboratively. The other thing too is that in some cases there may be less growth planned in one area that may assist another area in some of these solutions. So you need to plan this collaboratively.
In addition, for a private sector, they may have an issue that they simply cannot solve themselves, but they could buy into a municipal solution, and so that would be a collaborative solution to their problem. But it has to occur through the municipal solution, the water plan.
We'll take the next part.
Okay.
Thanks,
Tracy. This is probably for Dan. In the table on page 2, when we look at the distribution of the HUCs that are in deficit, when we calculate what those deficits were, those are current as opposed to under build-out conditions?
That's correct.
So those could go one way or the other, depending on sort of these decisions. It may be worse. I mean, it goes to the question of, my second question, which is how did you, if you could explain to me sort of simply how you determined the breakpoints in the conceptual approach to scale mitigation, which ones you decided were ones that should go prior, mitigation should be in place prior to authorizing the projects versus otherwise.
Okay. With regard to the deficits in the hot sales, it's 2003 conditions, and so the expectation is that those will change over time. In some places, we're seeing reductions. Morris County took a look at their 1990s and 2000s water use, and it went down by 22% during that period of time. In other places, we're seeing increases because of development pressure, so it will change, and absolutely, that's true. With regard to the conceptual table, those are conceptual values. They are policy-driven. They're based on a sense of the deficit size and the amount of use. The larger the amount of use, the more intense the development that is driving that use, and therefore the more opportunity they should have from an economic perspective to do something better. Again, in a larger deficit area, the need is more critical, and therefore we would push it up. There's no absolute magic to those numbers. I mean, you could come up with 137.25, and it wouldn't be no better a number or worse than 150%. It's just it's a table to drive a result.
I have a comment. The deficits in Morris County, I would have to believe, are somewhat caused by the fact that Jersey City and Newark are drawing huge amounts of water from our watershed.
I think Don's going to answer that.
And, you know, if they continue to develop, they'll continue to draw more, and we'll continue to increase the deficits no matter what restrictions we put on within the Highlands region.
Actually, the water that is taken from reservoirs, which have their own safe yields, are completely separate from the water availability analyses that we do here. We are entirely focused on groundwater use and the use of surface water that does not involve a reservoir or a safe field. So they could take every drop of water that's available to them and it would not change the deficits at all. The Morris County deficits are primarily caused by the movement of water and sewerage across sub-watershed lines. That's the really critical issue. And so in the case of say, the Rockaway Valley, which is a great example, all of that water from upstream of the Jersey City or Boonton Reservoir is groundwater supplied, and it is then transported around the reservoir to the lower Rockaway. So that's a deficit, that's a depleted water use, and that drives in major, major way, the deficits that are upstream of the Jersey City Reservoir. So that's where those deficits are coming from, not from the use of the reservoirs at all.
You have to give me a bigger lesson in this. I find that hard to understand.
That would be fine.
Other comments or questions at this point?
I have a clarification question, John.
Go ahead.
Where these, I forget the term now I use, the water conservation management plan that Eileen referred to, is that the right term?
Water use and conservation management plan.
Okay. Are we going to discuss how sort of pragmatically, practically, or on the street that fits into the conformance process? Is that part of the discussion today?
No.
I can defer this till a later point.
These plans were already in the 07 final draft, and the council had approved a grant to work with Town of Clinton, with whom we're doing the first pilot project. But these plans are necessary for us to work with municipalities to meet the mandates of the Act. But there's something you've already approved in the original master plan.
Well, I understand that. My question is more now, how will we actually implement that's a step that would need to be taken. How would that fit into the entire process? I mean, would we make we would not grant conformance until this is done, and then we would make, I'm thinking out loud here, we would require implementation of that plan as a part of actual conformance, not just the legal action of conformance, but actually, I'm just trying to figure out practically how one of the, and what mechanisms would exist to implement such a conservation plan.
Okay, well, what we're doing is, with there are many plans required through the conformance process, and when we talked a few weeks ago about how to do this in the time, the legislature said it was 9 to 15 months after adoption of the plan, with all those lands within the preservation area, had to go through conformance. So what we did was we set up what we called basic plan conformance, which was what you needed to do in order to get conditional conformance. Because we see this, just like you're saying, Debbie, this is going to take a long time, A, to get to do these plans, and B, implementation. So towns can be working with us on these issues. They don't have to have completed all these plans in order to get conditional conformance. But they will have an action plan set forth whereby they have to achieve and do all these plans, and then implementation will be monitored over time, because in order to stay in conformance, you must A, have the work, the plans done, and B, implementation of them. Otherwise, you will no longer be in conformance. So this is going to be ongoing for all time, really, because it's the basic nature of even a town's master plan and ordinance, is that continual monitoring of achieving your goals through your ordinances. And just as we update the plan and work with the towns to update their ordinances to stay in conformance.
So I think the simple answer to the question I'm asking is that the certification or the granting of conformance is the ultimate power or whatever for a town to. And I understand what you're saying. It's over time and it's ongoing. It's not going to happen overnight or just be done once it happens. But it's actual, the certification, if that's the right term, of conformance is what the mechanism is ultimately to, if not ensure, but encourage or require that towns conform to these plans. Is that correct?
You're correct. It will be required, because even though they get a certificate, which is conditioned upon the next actions, should they fail to do those next actions, they do not stay in conformance with the regional master plan. So that's another quote-unquote power or hook you have there, because just
right.
Because they get that certificate doesn't mean that they walk away from the table and they're done. That won't be the case. They have to stay in conformance.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Recognizing these issues, but did you have something else you want to say before we go on to the next one?
Yeah, I'm just trying to get it, but I was going to go back to your question, yeah. Which is what's different in this proposal? The fundamental policy question about whether or not we're going to allow or provide for conditional water availability in deficit areas is not changed. We're still saying staff is recommending that we continue to allow or provide for conditional water availability in deficit areas.
But with more restrictions.
With
right.
Changes in the mitigation
right.
requirements. So, and along those break lines, there would be some changes in some watersheds and some, and not in others.
Well, also, I think in response to comments received about can they do the work beforehand, that's responded to. Greater understanding of the certainty of mitigation. So there was more work and analysis done there to respond to comments received. And then water conservation techniques and the aggregate impacts. All of this was in response to comments received. So offering greater clarification of how one can mitigate and achieve this mitigation. So I think that it's not just the scaling of it, but it's also the fact that the more background work to support the staff's recommendation to the council.
So on the certainty aspect of it, I mean, I think you've given us more detail about the technologies or the management approaches, but maybe it's a little bit along the lines of Debbie's question. Where's the greater assurance that those approaches are going to be implemented and are actually going to change the water availability conditions on the ground, particularly in those watersheds where we're continuing to recommend that we allow development to move forward prior to the successful implementation of the mitigation strategy?
And I think some of that, again, is taken care of in the next couple of slides, because we talk about what we would expect from the applicant in these cases.
Well, let's get those slides up and continue the discussion.
I hope they answer some.
The next document is for mitigation of new consumptive or depleted water uses in sub-watersheds having water deficits. What we talk about here is the goals, policy, and objective recommendations, clarifying that conditional water availability is a maximum for all projects. And that's what I said at the beginning of the last group of slides as well, not allowed for each project. In other words, you know, in a deficit hub, there's a certain amount of conditional water. When that is used, it's gone. It's not that amount of conditional water for each project. A water use and conservation management plan will be used instead of the standard mitigation threshold. So once you've got that plan in place, that's what dictates the future. And then incorporating that sliding scale we talked about for mitigation thresholds. And the program change to require implementation with construction or within 1 year at most, if less than 20,000 gallons per day in the planning area or 10,000 gallons per day in the preservation area. In the final draft, that was 100,000 and 50,000. So that's a change there. Now, providing, we would require the detailed mitigation plans were provided with, and this gets, I hope, to some of what Tracy was asking, engineering drawings of mitigation facilities or detailed plans, if not based on facilities. Demonstration that each measure is feasible and that the combination of those measures meets the mitigation requirements. Recharge shown to support aquifer recharge or stream flow beyond 2 months' time of travel. And operation management monitoring requirements, including responsible entity and metrics for success. And providing a cost estimate with a 10% contingency. That would then be providing an escrow fund or bonding to ensure implementation. And so those escrow funds wouldn't be released until that had been proven. If on-site conservation conditioned before the issuance of the certificate of occupancy, if on-site recharge included in the stormwater management plan and constructed as part of the project again before the certificate of occupancy. The responsible entity for mitigation plan must report annually to the Highlands Council through the life of the escrow account bond, and must establish a long-term reporting system prior to the release of those escrows. Reporting continues until the deficit is eliminated or alternate reporting system is established through, again, that water use and conservation management plan.
So, what are the circumstances in which a certificate of occupancy would be approved before the mitigation plan was necessarily completed? Be it off-site, where it was off-site?
Yeah, it would be for an off-site project that is in excess of the either 20,000 in the planning area or 10,000 in the preservation area threshold. So these are situations where you're talking about a longer period of time necessary than to implement the project than necessary the CO would give you. So we want to put a maximum time on that. We want to make sure that there is a third party essentially ensuring and monitoring the compliance with the project. We want to make sure that there's annual reporting to the Highlands Council so that we can know that things are being done properly. But that's basically where it is. It's when you're dealing with off-site efforts. Otherwise, it makes sense if you're doing on-site conservation, you can't conserve it before you've done your project. If you're doing on-site recharge, you can't create the recharge before you've created the project that creates the water that's going to be recharged. So that has to really stay with the construction process.
But there would be projects, there would be a period of time where a new project would be making the water deficit worse before it got better, right? Before the mitigation was required to be in place.
If it hadn't been triggered by the mitigation thresholds that were in the prior paper. So this is one set of situations where it's just sort of blanket policy. And then in a situation where you have a high deficit, it doesn't really matter what size the project is, you still have to create it prior to the creation of the use, the water use. So it's, these are overlapping or overlying policies, and whichever one is more stringent would apply in a particular situation.
I'm confused. So are there projects where a project would be using, a project in deficit area would be using water, the mitigation we required would not be in place before the project started operation using water, consuming water?
Yes, you could have a situation where you have a relatively small use in a relatively low deficit area, but it's an off-site project and you need 2 years to do it instead of one. You could get that 2 years.
And that would be the items that were in red, those areas that would not apply to, because that has to be done before.
That's right.
And we expect the town building inspector to monitor this?
No, actually, we
will have it in-house. We'll be monitoring, tracking, sending him a notice, do not issue a building.
Okay.
CO. In terms of
whether they get the CO, it becomes a condition of local approval, and therefore the building permit, building inspector,
I understand the beginning of the process. It's
right.
The end of the process.
Right. It's like every other project approval with its 49 conditions that are on it. Mm-hmm. It's
part of that list.
No, but who makes the determination?
Right.
Municipalities probably don't have on staff the kind of people that would be able to evaluate, whether or not this has been built just to plan.
Right.
So who's going to make that determination?
And that's a great question.
Will the building inspector have to sit there and wait for us or somebody? Who's going to say this is conforming to the plan that was approved?
Eileen, if we could go back to the prior slide, I think. Okay. Responsible entity. That's a critical issue. Basically, what we're saying is this. If it's on-site, then your municipal engineer knows how to determine whether or not a recharge basin got built according to the specs that were approved. If it's on-site conservation, your inspectors have the ability to know whether or not the building has the right fixtures in it, and so on. Off-site, that's where this third party, this responsible entity for the monitoring and tracking, what I would suggest to, and we're going to have to write up all the detailed procedures and performance standards on this, but the easiest way of doing this is for your municipality to require that responsible entity confirm to the municipality that it was done.
Who is that, Dan?
Okay.
Who's the third party in this?
It would have to be somebody that the developer is contracted with to ensure that the process occurs.
What if it's the utility? Can the developer contract with the utility to have the work done?
Yes.
And then what if something goes wrong, not wrong, but gets delayed? Now the developers started construction, essentially substantially completed construction, but yet the utility, through other reasons, hasn't finished their part of it. How hamstrung is what happens at that point in the project?
General approach here would be if they're restricted to having it in place before the CO, then they're stuck.
Let's say that they've sold the houses in a subdivision, and people are counting on moving in, and because of this, we say you can't. Now, we're really going to have a problem with lawsuits all over the place.
Well, I guess the question is, are we requiring mitigation or are we not?
Well, I think the real question is the implementation and enforcement mechanism so complex that the policy of allowing the development to go forward prior to the mitigation being provided doesn't work?
That's the fundamental issue about why we did a scaled analysis to say the red numbers, which is in those cases there would not be the ability to go forward.
No, I understand it. So you took the fundamental policy question and split it in two, and I think what we're kind of working through here is that even in those cases where we're saying in small deficits, in small watersheds for small projects, is this workable? And you're proposing that the mechanism be an enforcement through the CO, right, primarily with some third party who may or may not have any legitimate authority to enforce these questions, being responsible for ensuring that the implementation.
Well, I think it's important to say that when a project is approved, through the first bullet there, is that you are, through the approval process, ensuring that it's designed to meet the mitigation requirements. So it's not as if we're waiting until the CO to confirm. The CO is just the action. The approval process itself is going to ensure that the engineering's been done to meet the specs.
I'm sorry, I was very imprecise. The responsible party doesn't enforce anything. It's the council's rules, it's the municipality's decision with regard to the responsible entity. It's basically most developers are not, they don't have the expertise to deal with a lot of these issues, and especially with regards to some of the offsite things. So it can be the utility, it could be a municipality if they want to buy into a municipal project, but the basic issue is to have someone else who has expertise to understand whether something was done or not done, and can certify that to the people who are actually responsible for the decision, which is the council with regard to the reporting, and the municipality with regard to the decision. So they're not enforcement entities, and I misspoke. I wasn't clear with regard to that. They're not enforcement entities.
Question. I'd like to back up a little bit. I think we do have a lot of questions here about how it actually is verified before CO is given. But backing up a little bit, I think Tim's point encompasses a big part of the issue. I'd like to expand it a little bit because I also think that I don't have the confidence that those areas that are in red, where you have to show prior to approval that you have accomplished this mitigation, also have a reliable measurement in place. And I think, you know, this is a problem that we have, you know, been debating about whether or not mitigation really is reliable. Certainly, we know infiltration works, we know recharge works, we know that you can improve stormwater management by holding it back. However, in terms of exact gallonage and how much water is then going to be able to be used by a house, for instance, I question whether it's that precise. And my concern, I've been thinking about it looking at this this paper, and I'm wondering, when you say, for instance, that you'll be using DEP, you know, recharge, it's tried and true, their calculations that they put together, are we going to be using then the guidance in the stormwater BMP manual in terms of how infiltration systems are constructed and how much credit you're given for the amount of water that's recharged to the site? Is that what we're going to be relying on?
Until something identifies a need for different guidance or a different technical method, that's the method we have available to us, and it's as you say, right. So, yes, the idea would be that we start with that, and then if we ever identify a need for change, we would change.
Well, I just think we should dig a little deeper into that issue if we're really going to consider using mitigation plans and starting to count drops of water or gallons of water that you get out of them. Because, for instance, with an infiltration system, a DEP doesn't require that you do soil testing like you would for a septic system, for instance, in order to figure out, you know, how much water you're actually going to recharge as opposed to get into the shallow aquifer that would go quickly to a stream, but recharge to the aquifer where the wells draw from. And, you know, it's one of the criticisms that have been brought up about the DEP infiltration system designs. And that kind of thing is the kind of detailed information I would think we were going to need in order to have the confidence that this mitigation is actually going to deliver water to the wells where the water is drawn from for the projects that we're approving. So I think, you know, we if we really want to start counting on this, I think we have to start developing as a council and working on this down the road. I think it's not developed enough for us to use now. I think we should not rely on this to allow us to use water. Yeah, new projects, water for new projects in current deficit areas. But down the road, as we move forward to try to work on these water management and conservation plans, that we need to be looking at, you know, how much water can you actually recharge in the Highlands? We know from our nitrate analysis and the septic density studies, very little. So how much are you really extra? Are you really going to be able to put into these hard rock geologies? And those types of questions that are going to give us actual gallons of water that are going to be available for these projects, I think is the kind of certainty we need in order to rely on this approach. And I think we're not there. And I think we, you know, it's fine for us as an exercise to move forward with this because we have to address these problems, but not as, you know, to giving us, not assuming that this gives us a comfort level that we can then allow continued use or extra and additional use in current deficit areas.
Two things that I'd like to just respond, Tracy, and one is that obviously we would, here we're discussing the policy, then we've got to get to the detailed procedures for these. But I think what we have to remember is that if this is the policy you did decide to go with, you get to see each of these projects and each of these plans, and if they haven't convinced you that they can mitigate, you get to say no. So, and they are going to be, they're going to be very different. I mean, we anticipate that each project will be, just as we are with the WQMPs, each one is unique. But if you're not satisfied, if the council is not satisfied that they're able to mitigate, you get to say this project just, it hasn't convinced me. So it's a question of whether you're saying to these 114 municipalities, sorry, sub-watersheds right now that it's capped based on our you know, very conservative analysis of deficit, or whether we start this conversation of how do we mitigate, and we have to start this conversation somewhere. But then it's over to you as to what you want to do with the policy.
Is this any different from any other environmental constraint that is put on a development? We have environmental consultants actively working for municipalities who advise the municipalities and planning boards on these issues and make the stipulate the requirements for any conservation measures or anything else. Is this substantially different from that kind of thing because it's in the Highlands?
I would say it's similar to what you're talking about, the conditions and
so we've done this before, in a sense. I mean, this, you're not recreating the wheel. You're just applying something that has already existed. Am I right? Tom's not.
I mean, this conditional approval on escrows is the way land use is done.
Right.
And you do have to rely upon that the analysis before the approval is valid.
Right.
In other words, there's no approval.
But there's a great cautionary tale in that model, which is the evaluation that was done of wetlands mitigation projects throughout the state found that the vast majority of them failed based on this idea of conditioning approvals, allowing the recreation or the enhancement of freshwater wetland systems by individual engineering firms associated with the development project. When the DEP was finally forced to go out and examine the success of that program, they found that most of those projects didn't work. So the mitigation that we anticipated, you know, coming out of the replacement of the lost resource value didn't happen because the engineering standards were wrong, the construction was wrong. And I think that's the caution in that we need to really tease through.
I think that's a very good point, and I don't disagree with that at all, but I think that we have a fallback that the DEP didn't have, which is the Highlands Council. We'll be watching that project, and if the mitigation that we're seeking is not working out, we will know that, and we'll be able to address that and make a mid-course correction, if you will.
I share your faith that we'll be better enforcers than that.
I'm not getting the warm and fuzzies, as my five-year-old would say, about this whole this process, because I understand what you're saying, Councilman Dreyer, that will be presented with the plan and the analysis, but how can you actually give a proper, reasonable vote for something if you have a question mark as to, let's say, this town engineer signing off on a CO, and you don't know what connection he or she may have with the company who's building? So there's like these question marks that I have in my head with regards to all of the facts being brought to the council for me to give a valid vote for.
We have to rely to some extent on municipal officials and assume their competence and integrity. And if we're not, if we can't do that, then we're sort of lost with this.
That's my answer. I mean, these are certified people in most cases. They have state licenses to do what they do. You have to have a certain amount of confidence in their decisions. You know, there was a groan when the word developer was used as the developer being the watchdog here. Not all developers are evil. I know there'll probably be more groans when I say that. But it's true. People are basically honest and of high integrity. And I think that there's nothing wrong with being skeptical and nothing wrong with demanding proofs. But I think that to make a blanket assumption about the lack of integrity and have lack of confidence in people who are supposed to be doing a good job destroys the entire fabric of what we're trying to do. We're not even trying to do.
But can I just say something?
Sure, sure.
But Councilman Schreier, it's not about attacking the credibility of a town official or anything like that, but this is something that's important, of paramount importance, about deficits in areas. And actually having the foresight to make sure that it is mitigated appropriately. And it's serious, so it's not anybody questioning anyone's integrity. It's just making sure that the system, a proper system, is in place.
I agree with that. I subscribe to the theory that you should trust but verify.
I just want to make we, the Highlands Council, we're the ones that will approve the mitigation plan?
Yes.
It seems to me that we should be the enforcer, and we should either approve it or not approve it. You know, in a municipality, ordinarily, the town engineer works with the applicant, and he approves whatever plan they're going to put forward, and then he will sign off on that. But if we're going to be the people approving the plan in the first place, it seems to me that the responsibility for approving the implementation of that resides with us.
You're saying that we should be the ones certifying that they have, in fact, put the plan in place.
We can put that into the procedures that they have to come back to us and prove, and that then we sort of serve our release.
Well, I think we have to be prepared to make the manpower, people power commitment to overseeing these things.
I would note that the council's responsibility is to have a consistency determination with regard to the regional master plan, which then goes to the municipality, and then the planning board and the zoning board actually approves the development, but it's based on our consistency determination. So just a fine point with regard to that.
Mr. Chairman, yeah. Along the lines of trust but verify, the point that I was trying to make, and the question that I have, I don't think has been answered, is these measurements that we're going to be expecting be accomplished, this increase in water availability that comes out of this mitigation program, we're trusting it's going to happen based on these calculations that the engineer does at the beginning, but we are not going to be verifying. We're not going to be actually measuring, particularly when it comes to the individual homes. And, you know, in this paper we talk about in the preservation area, it's mainly going to be individual homes with individual septic systems. And most of the entire preservation area, except for redevelopment areas, are going to be that. How are we ever going to be able to measure the increased water that current deficit areas are receiving if we're having individual homes on individual wells with individual septic systems? I can't see how this is going to work, particularly when you consider that we're not going to be putting meters on individual homes and having them report back on a monthly basis to the council. So we're not verifying. We're just making these assumptions up front based on some numbers that are provided through DEP's stormwater program, which, you know, are estimates. They're not verifiable gallon-by-gallon accuracy. They don't provide that. And we're building a whole program on that. And then as far as the larger areas, where the larger deficits are, we talk about on page 4 these highly developed areas where, you know, we might be able to track this a little better. I would ask again, how are we going to be measuring? Are we actually going to have meters and we're going to see that there is now more water in the system than there was before in these larger deficit areas? Or are we going to be, again, assuming that the engineering calculations played out the way that we expected them to?
Perhaps we could create a water police force that's behind this council.
Well, see, that's what I'm saying. It's ridiculous. We're going to have a Highlands police force? It's ridiculous. We're not going to do that. For us to trust on something that requires that level of oversight and verification, I think goes back to what Tim said before. We're creating a system that just isn't going to work. We're not going to be able to really make it work. And it's on a wing and a prayer. Not, there's a lot of trust and there's no verification.
I don't think it's a wing and a prayer when there's certain, I mean, there's certain things you know. I mean, the range is a question. I don't know down to each gallon, but certainly there's a range and a certain engineering controls and technology that you can rely on within a range. But I think we have to emphasize this is an interim program because the object is to get to the water conservation use and management plans, or use and conservation management plans. But and that in the preservation area, those towns must conform, therefore they must do the plan. And in terms of putting this in place, when they hit the threshold, towns are going to quickly realize that the door is closing and that they're going to be, but it gives you, it starts that conversation, it starts mitigation for these deficits. But and in terms of towns that don't conform, they hit the threshold. So they're going to suddenly realize, and this is one of the sort of incentives in doing the planning, is if you as a town want to plan where any opportunity exists to build, you're going to want to do the plan so that you dictate where those uses are. So it's all geared to getting into the planning element. This is an interim step to get us there. And what we tried to do between 07 in response to the comments was to strengthen it.
Well, I just would have one comeback on that one that I think is kind of pretty clear that there would be, if that's true, then there would be even more of an incentive if you were not allowing expansion in areas of current deficit. Because if towns were already with the door closed, like in reality they are, they've used way too much water, they're in a deficit, and the door's already closed, we're going to work real hard to get a mitigation plan working with measurable results in order to be able to develop at all. So if that logic works, I think it works better if we don't allow growth in areas of current deficit.
I think the approach recommended by staff is good and an improvement over what was in the final draft. The one question I do have is Mimi's question before, because I think, in terms of Tracy, your last comment, I think there are sometimes situations where you need more money to be able to make the corrections, and the money is going to come from the development that's approved, that the municipality is not going to be in a position to do it otherwise. But I am concerned about what Mimi brought up, a subdivision example, where so there's a condition, so someone builds houses, someone else buys one of those houses and expects to move in, and we're then saying to that person, you can't have the town can't grant a CO until a developer who's a third party or a second party does some corrections. I can't picture how we would enforce that. I mean, how we would be able to say to the people on the street with their moving van, you can't move in.
Well, excuse me, John, but I think that the moving van wouldn't be on the street at that point. I think that we would know that issue. It would become apparent to us before the moving van arrived. And just like any other condition of approval for a certificate of occupancy. I mean, all of these conditions must be met before people can legitimately move into these homes. And this is just another one.
Well, I'm just about the words where the responsibility is removed, because I agree with you. I mean, I do think that makes sense for most cases, but I think where you have, where it's...
let's say the subdivision is going to be 50 homes or something. They couldn't get a CO for any one of them. until this was completed, whereas in the normal subdivision, you can give a CO provided whatever is on a particular street or block if the roads are done and whatever.
But maybe right? A threshold.
So now they can't get anything, and now I guess you run into some serious financial problems, I guess, for a developer, not that, of course, that's our concern, but it's going to cause a lot of problems, I think.
Well, maybe it's a threshold question. Would a development of that size be in the, lower or upper half of the table?
No. I don't know.
It could be in the upper half.
It'd be
in the area. Part of the table that doesn't require you to complete the project right. Before you build.
Right.
So I think the request is that we reconsider the mitigation for off-site and try to revise the policies for the off-site mitigation. Strengthen that.
My request, I think. I think somebody, Debbie, did you have a question?
Yeah, I'm listening to this to follow on. Can you all hear me, by the way?
Yes.
Okay. To follow up on a point Taisha made about, I don't get a warm fuzzy hearing this and listening to all of this, where I arrive at it is we know that permitting development in these water deficit areas, it's a certainty, absolute certainty that it will contribute to the deficit and worsen it. And there are theoretical program suggestions, policy requirements that may, and I underscore the word may, mitigate this increased deficit. I think that's what we really need to focus on, and frankly, hearing that programs are geared a certain way or that all developers are not crooked, I don't think that gets to the heart of that matter, which is we are supposed to be protecting the water supplies. And we're not going to be able to assure we can do that if we follow policy. That's what I would suggest people think about as we go forward.
You were shaking your head at that. You have a...
Well, the program's design is... the statement was it's a certainty that you're going to worsen the deficit. I think that's the exact opposite of what this is intended to do, is to ensure that the deficit will actually improve.
Right.
That's the whole 125% concept.
I'm sorry, I can't hear whoever's speaking.
That was Tom. I'm sorry. The policy is in what you were saying is that it's a certainty that the deficit will get worse. I think the policy is the exact opposite, is that it's recommending that the 125% mitigation ensure that the deficit is alleviated.
No, what I'm saying is unless you can guarantee an effective mitigation, it's a certainty. It's a certainty. Without question, that additional development drawing water will contribute to a deficit. And writing a policy that says we'll require 125% recharge does not counter that. Those are words on a piece of paper. Whether or not in reality we're able to achieve that, that's what's questionable.
Well, I mean, that's clearly your opinion. That's, I think, what the staff paper's been, and Eileen and Tom and Dan's presentations have been saying, is that based on their analysis and research, it's not questionable. I mean, in most,
That's if you can successfully have a remediation program. I'm separating the two things, John. We know that the development will contribute. As it is, by in and of itself, it will contribute. The question is whether or not you can effectively have a remediation program that will counter that. But we know additional development drawing water will create additional water demands, and will that element by itself contribute to the deficit?
Right.
Okay. John, I just had a question on this conceptual approach to scale mitigation requirements on page 5. Have we attempted, the staff attempted to run these numbers based on build-out?
We're doing the build-out now, and so this will play into all of this, we'll see. But then that's why I also spoke to the other fact that this doesn't take into consideration other limiting factors. So when you're in the preservation area, you have the septic. Septic is really the limiting factor there. Mm-hmm. So this can't be considered on its own. So build-out will tell us a lot more, but this has to be seen in the context of all the goals, policies, and objectives of the plan.
Well, it seems like it would be very instructive for the council to know what these numbers are based on build-out, because if some could get worse, some could get better, this whole chart could change.
I think what build-out will show you
is the answers to if we have 100% conformance to plan, where, you know, what the build-out looks at versus just the preservation area conformance. All of that will be very telling.
Well, I mean, there are clearly different points of view here, and I guess the question is whether there's a majority of the council that wants to fundamentally revisit the policy decision that we made in the November draft to allow development with the best mitigation program we can design in the in-deficit areas, or whether we want to do away, you know, reverse that decision, or make sure we're doing this, going this direction, and as well as we can, and make the changes that may be appropriate from the conversation we've had today and subsequent ones. So I guess at this point, just so we can get to the other issues here, not necessarily put this to bed forever, how many people on the council would like to change this policy or change this policy recommendation? Anybody on the front? Debbie, are you?
I am not comfortable with the staff recommendation. I'm not sure how that means I vote on this. So count my vote however that means.
Okay. Well, at this point, so three hands. So I think at this point, then we'll continue in this direction, but try to ask the staff to continue to try to respond to the comments that have come up here in terms of improving the mitigation program to be as reliable as possible. That's basically what I think they're saying.
Right, exactly why they've made that determination.
Right.
That
was
how
we
read.
Okay.
Right.
So let's go on.
Mr. Chair, just I guess in that sort of further consideration, it to me that the breakpoint that you all recommend about what should be mitigated prior to construction and what could go without it was fundamentally about this idea that the larger projects in the more developed areas have more resources available to them to implement the mitigation. Is that indeed the dominant sort of?
It's a major factor.
You also said it was easier for them to do it.
Oh, absolutely.
And that was a major consideration as we discussed was that they actually could achieve that before
the
project.
Somebody doing five houses is, among other things, might have a lot of different level of expertise in their company than somebody who's doing 100 house subdivisions.
Okay. I'll have to think more about that, but it just seems to me that part of that indicates that, given that difficulty, that those watersheds are probably never going to resolve the deficit issues going forward. So,
certainly they will not through site-by-site mitigation, and we recognize that in the paper. The site-by-site mitigation is a very short-term thing. The only way that those larger deficits are going to be addressed is through these water use and conservation management plans, and the largest of the deficits are likely only addressable through some very concerted infrastructure-based kinds of programs.
Okay. And Mr. Chairman, can we also ask the staff to rethink the process by which these
procedures
be approved?
Put in place. Okay. The next document that we're talking about in the PowerPoint is the document that's headed Guidance for Evaluation of Water Transfers Between Sub-Watersheds. Okay, public comments we've received on water transfers between sub-watersheds. We've received comments. We've also had discussions with the Department of Environmental Protection, and it confirmed the need for procedures to confirm that no other viable alternative exists. That is the policy that was set forth in the 07 final draft plan, that you only would consider a transfer if no other viable alternative exists. So for these procedures, we've set forth that we would update net water availability to the recent years. That would be done annually. Recharge must meet NJAC 7:8 standards. Show projected monthly and seasonal demand.
provide detailed water use protocol based on drought year impacts, rely on the lowest quality water appropriate unless unacceptable environmental impacts projected. So that allows you for the consideration of, for example, use of grey water, which did come up at a WQMP amendment. And we hadn't covered that in 07, in our draft, so we thought that was important to include. Show that proposed July, August groundwater and September surface water use is less than net or conditional water availability. If all available sources are not sufficient to meet project needs, identify those shortfalls. Determine the options such as project changes, irrigation restrictions, water transfers, plus any required mitigation for use of conditional water availability in source sub-watershed. If water transfers are required, identify the minimum quantity required and economically feasible. Determine if proposed source sub-watershed has sufficient water availability, net, conditional, safe yield for reservoirs, or non-highlands. Transfers from non-highland sources and surface water safe yields must also have NJDEP approval, as will most intra-highlands transfers. And again, in the 07, we didn't address the issue of transfers from outside of the region into the region, and that came up under one of our WQMP amendments. Council may approve transfers outside this process, and I think this is obvious, for public health and safety, subject to NJDEP approval and commitment to above analysis. So we think the analysis is still important, but we always recognise public health and safety, those kind of waivers. So what this is a tightening up of the policy that you proposed in 07 and looking at issues that we hadn't addressed then because, you know, when as they came before us into WQMP amendments, we realised the importance of putting those in place. We did discuss this with Department of Environmental Protection as well because they had given us significant comments on the water transfers, and they believe this is consistent with their how they would like to see our approach as well.
Comments, questions?
In the analysis of no viable alternatives, is there any consideration of the character of the use? In other words, bringing a water transfer in from out of the highlands to support a golf course, you know, someone may say, well, that's the only alternative available to me. And then, soon we get into this, they meet these greater standards, there's still a fundamental question about whether or not the project is going to go versus not, as opposed to something that has a more public nature to it, which might... there's been very few instances I've ever seen where viable alternatives, when there were, you know, no viable alternatives, and creativity never ceases to amaze me, is how people can find a way to justify projects. So,
we put Houston as the exception. In the last one, in terms of public health and safety, but not predetermining what use, I think so was Dan misspeaking.
Okay. So I don't understand what you're saying.
Well, I was just saying that we're not saying what types of uses we would limit this to, but we are providing the exception for public health and safety to allow it for those types of uses.
Yeah, in the RMP, if it's an allowable use and it meets all of the RMP resource policies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, the one question is whether or not they can manage that use using available water without a transfer, then they would need to go through these kinds of issues. And even there, we do want them to take a look at project changes and irrigation restrictions as a way of reducing the need. So the idea is to minimize the transfer to only what is absolutely necessary to supply a highlands of approvable use.
A question on, first of all, I still think this is a bad idea. We see that we brought ourselves into so much trouble by these transfers that we're continuing to allow them. This doesn't make any sense.
Tracy, could you speak up, please?
Under number two, the last line there, encroachment on prime groundwater recharge areas may also affect recharge requirement. How would that? What do you mean by that?
The RMP policy states that if you encroach on prime groundwater recharge area, you then have to provide not 100% mitigation of groundwater recharge, as in the DEP rules, but 125% mitigation. So basically, you touch a groundwater recharge area and it increases your recharge requirement. And of course, since that's the area that's prime groundwater recharge, that should be fairly easy to meet. But we do require it.
I would just like to repeat, I think we should take a closer look at NJAC 7:8 and see what the Highlands version of that would be in terms of recharge capabilities and what sort of testing, soil testing is required in order to prove the recharge abilities at a particular project.
Which part of the code is that?
That's the stormwater.
This is stormwater. Other comments?
Yeah, I have a question. You know, the classic way that most developments deal with flood possibilities is by building retention or detention basins. Is that going to become a problem for us? I mean, the detention basins, I guess they eventually let the water out to maybe a different watershed. So are we going to refuse to allow retention and detention basins to be built for, you know, flood storage? Or are we going to require that that all be recharged? And then if you're in an area that's not amenable to recharge, then what do we do?
Detention,
I mean, these are the practical problems that we're going to face.
Detention and retention basins are not an issue with regard to loss of water availability because they're storing wet weather flows and eventually they get released or the excess water in the retention basin gets released. The really critical issue is that, and what we're seeing, is that in more and more cases where a developer used to propose a detention basin, they are now proposing a recharge basin, and that's a direct result of DEP's requirements. The other reason for the change from detention basins is that you usually can't get the water quality improvement that you need for stormwater from that. So standard detention basins are less and less frequently used. We're going to see that go away, but it does not cause an issue with regard to, as long as you handle your recharge in some appropriate fashion, it does not cause a problem with regard to water availability.
But we will be encouraging recharge basins in lieu of detention basins.
Wherever they're feasible, absolutely.
And just a comment.
Maybe we should have some kind of comment in the plan stating that.
Well, one of the issues with both those approaches is over time, the maintenance of those operations typically are addressed to the homeowners associations. But I want to tell you, when you've got an 8-acre basin that has been silted in, the homeowners association may not have the wherewithal to facilitate that. So, I mean, part of what we need to think about in all of these mitigation efforts is the long-term sustainability of the solutions that are offered by the engineers, and the fact that we're not living in a 5 or a 10-year a time frame. And that, you know, when we talk about bonding or putting aside, we need to consider how that maintenance is going to take place. And that really ought to be on the applicant that's coming in looking for an exception or to build and to provide for it. Maybe it's a trust. I'm not sure what the vehicle would be, but, you know, every municipality in the state in this area is facing that detention basin issue in terms of how to deal with it. So we shouldn't just say, well, you know, great, you built a recharge basin, that's wonderful, you've met your criteria, only to come back 10 years later and find out that it's full of mud.
That ends up on the towns.
And that's one reason why the RMP has a blanket requirement, really, for low-impact development, because you want to reduce the amount of stormwater that you're even generating. And so that gets to it. The other issue is there are municipalities that do, in fact, require developers to create sinking funds for stormwater maintenance, and the municipality then takes on that responsibility using that money. West Windsor is a great example of that. They have a very, very good program that does exactly that. So these things can be considered by municipalities.
All I'm saying is that might be a component in all of our discussions about mitigation in terms of the sustainability of the effort that's being done.
Bill, your point is well taken, and I think it also gets to the water conservation use and management plans to work with municipalities to address this issue. Okay.
I'm sorry, just to follow up. So
So, Dan, that's within the authority of municipalities now to create, or is it a municipal utility authority?
The municipality has been doing it through the planning board process and establishing this, and it's not a utility authority, it's actually through the public works program. But it's an independent fund that is established by the developer for the maintenance of that particular basin. There is a bill in the legislature now that would authorize the establishment of stormwater utilities, which would allow for a much more uniform program for doing that. I would agree with Mr. Cogger that having homeowners associations handle these facilities is terrible. A nightmare.
I should work that into the recommendation somewhere along the line. I
don't know. Yes, that's the same thing. Thank you.
Very much. Go ahead.
Cluster development? Okay, there's two documents that you need to be aware of as we go through this. One is the white paper, conservation plans and best management practices, upon which our recommendations are based. This was a research paper done by staff, Erica Webb did this, and we did work with Department of Ag on these issues too, and then RCS, so she worked very closely with them. Just to let you know, we did get some edits to this paper from Monique Purcell in the Department of Ag, and we'll be incorporating some of those changes. They are sort of refining the document, and no substantive changes, but refining it. So just to let you know that. The other paper we'll be looking at is cluster development goals, policies, and objectives. Again, this is...
Can you just let us know, though, sort of what the scope of the Department of Agriculture's comments are on this? I thought this paper was very insightful and really cast a lot of light on the success or lack of success of voluntary programs for certain issues. So I'm just interested in hearing specifically what AI has to say before we adopt the recommendations.
Maybe the chair will help for that.
Sure.
Because we did have a lot of interaction on this because we wanted to discuss those issues about, you know, implementation and making sure it occurs and who was the appropriate people to do that. So, and some of the changes in this actually already reflect Department of Ag's comments on NRCS staff and Department of Ag staff as well, working on these issues with us.
Why don't you go through your explanation of the two papers, and then we'll ask Monique to...
Okay, the white paper, what it really did was gave us, we were looking at the policy that we had discussed in the 2007 final draft on using the Act's 3% and 9% triggers for particular plans, the Farm Conservation Plan and the Resource Management Systems Plans. And in the Act, it was for ag impervious cover, and that was used in the 07 draft for where there would be a cluster on farmland such as in the conservation zone. But what we discovered doing this white paper was what we were looking to see was what would be the most useful and the most meaningful to attain our goals, what kind of planning should be done, and also what were the appropriate triggers. And so that's the background then for what we'll go through on these couple of slides. In general, we added the relevant goal policies and objectives from different areas, utility, agricultural resources, future land use, and the landowner fairness sections of the regional master plan to list of the clustered goals, policies and objectives to provide clarification on when to use cluster techniques and cluster design principles. In the next, there's a recommended change which is underlined. We had in the 2007 draft the cluster development that would preserve at least 80% of the project area in perpetuity for environmental protection or agricultural purposes. We've refined that to speak to where the cluster would be served by infrastructure. And so the underlying section now reads, to the maximum extent feasible, the developed portion, that is not including wetlands, open water buffers and recreational lands, occupies no more than 10% of the project area if served by public or community
on-site wastewater system. So the goal is to even increase from the 80% the amount of land that you save, you know, protect and preserve in perpetuity when the cluster is served by public or community on-site wastewater systems.
Are septic systems considered on-site wastewater?
No. Sorry. The goals, policy, and objective changes then under agricultural resources. Clarification has been provided on when to use cluster techniques and that the cluster design should maintain and enhance the agricultural industry. You see their policies 3A6 and objectives 3A6A through 3A6D. Cluster development is mandatory in the agricultural resources area when other preservation tools such as fee simple, easements and TDR are not feasible. Cluster development ordinance and ag retention and farmland preservation plan require continued agricultural viability and implementation of best management practices. Instead of using impervious cover triggers to dictate the type of conservation plan, this gets to the findings of that white paper, an NRCS farm conservation plan would be developed and implemented that focuses on soil and water resources. And that is the focus that gets us to the mission of the Highlands Council. And so rather than talking about triggers of 3%, 9%, it's just blanket. If you're doing using the cluster development, you would have this NRCS farm conservation plan developed and implemented. The next two slides were just, because I was asked about a visual on this. On the left here, you see sort of the effect of scattered development. And on the right, you see that clustered development. It just shows you the trying to draw this away from sprawl. And also remembering without density bonus. And then through working with municipalities through conformance, and this is the comprehensive type of planning that really is our goal and our mission, is to address the concern about potential for multiple and uncoordinated clusters, that working through the plan conformance process, you would encourage municipal planning at the get-go to sit down with them and say, where are their opportunities, and where are their opportunities then to make sure the clusters are clustered. So it's sort of like, if you think about it, a three-step sprawl is your sort of the worst-case scenario, and then getting down to clusters, and then trying to get those clusters together so that you maximize protection of the area. Just want to emphasize as well that, because you know it's a concern, that, and it's been addressed numerous occasions, that there is no consideration in the preservation area of extension of sewers for anything other than what the Act allows for. We've addressed that before on numerous occasions. I'm just emphasizing that point here today.
Well, what's the reason for recommending the change from 80% to 90% site coverage?
It's really because if you're going to use sewer for these, then you should be intensifying the area where you develop and making better use of sewers. So I think later on what we do is actually have a slide under utilities that speaks to the amount of land that would be used for the development if it was serviced by sewer versus septic. And you have a great opportunity under sewer to condense the development. And so it becomes more feasible to get greater than 80% protection.
Do we envision a higher density on that 10% then? In other words, when we look at the whole, do calculations based on 100% of the property,
and then you take that development.
20%, you put it on 10%.
Correct.
And that last slide with the clustering of clusterings, is that, I'm trying to figure my way through that one, is that like a TDR within a...
That's part of what the discussion is. Some of this can be. You can use TDR to do some of this. You can use, there are various things you can utilize to make this happen. TDR is certainly part of the process. What we looked at was the Mansfield WP1P we had and discussed the various ways you could better utilize an area where you have sewer availability adjacent to existing, etc., so that you could maximize the potential of using the sewer and preserving elsewhere, and TDR was one of the mechanisms you'd use there.
Can we talk about density bonus? We thought about numbers of housing. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
We talk about number of houses. How about number of units? I guess one of the concerns that I have when we talk about clustering is, are we going to bump, are we going to go from single-family houses up to, you know, three-story condos with multiple units and in the cluster area? Or are we talking about maintaining the same number of dwelling units as opposed to intensifying the use, if you will?
Let's clarify, we're not talking about this in the existing community zone because it's different policies that apply there. So we're talking about, and I just want to make sure that we're clear on that, we're talking about taking what could be done and moving it into a cluster. We're not talking about changing the underlying, what would be allowed there. So if there would be three single family residences, then it would be three single family residences clustered.
Okay, and is we going to, are we going to allow for transferring in of dwellings into a cluster area from other areas within the community? In other words, are we going to designate a cluster in one location and say, well, we're going to preserve these parcels of land and we're going to allow that to be transferred into that one cluster?
Yes.
So on a 50-acre parcel, we could wind up with 25 acres being developed as long as there's an offset within the community of other land. Now, is any consideration given to the viable use of that land in the community? In other words, am I going to trade you 10 acres of non-buildable land for a dwelling unit in this cluster?
No, it would be, you would have to show the what could be done on the land, and that would be what would be transferred over into the cluster.
Okay, so we're not...
So I take your point, and absolutely no, we're not.
I'm just trying to...
No, you're... Down, you're absolutely right. It would be what could, what is developable, not taking sort of
so
wet lands and saying, okay,
we're dealing oranges and oranges, and we're
exactly
dealing being developable and developable.
The object of the exercise here is to take what could happen and move it to cluster development so that you can continue to have viable ag lands or protect natural resources as well, but not any of, you know, taking exactly what could happen and transferring it.
And two last comments. We're able to work out a way that farmers can actually farm the land, so that we're able to not run into the problems that we've had in the past. And
is this concern about NLUL?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
I mean, there's various techniques that are allowable under this land use law that ensures this to be protected. The Farm Bureau went up against East Anvil, actually, over this very issue, and the courts have decided on that issue. There are various techniques that aren't allowed as well, which would have to be avoided. But certainly there are techniques, lot averaging, open land, non-contiguous cluster. So all of that would have to be consistent with this plan as well.
And certainly with TDR, then you're transferring the development rights, but the land from which those development rights are transferred remains in private ownership.
And then I guess we say, when we say allowed, who makes the determination of what's allowed? Is that the prior zoning allowance? Is it?
It's what would be allowed under the plan. And I know you're doing this for clarification.
Right, yes.
On point of clarification, I don't find any of that in the language of the proposals. So if indeed we're talking about no changes in the terminology used in one part of this is the development yield of the site, that ought to be clarified. And I'll read the question later on as to how we're going to do that if we're talking about a site that has a certain development yield absent sewers and somebody wants to pay millions of dollars and bring a sewer line out into the fields of Chester, that they're not going to want higher densities. But so that question, then the question about which techniques that are authorized under the municipal land use law that would indeed keep the preserved portion of that property in agriculture need to be articulated in this because they're not. And I think we're going to get trouble, you know, if we don't do that.
Okay, well, we can certainly take care of that. And we'll take it.
Question. I wanted to get back to the pond conservation. The paper very well lays out the thresholds, too, and points out that we're really not going to get to 3 or 9% very often with the type of farming that we see in the Highlands. But I think also it's made very clear that the pond conservation plan really is very limited. It addresses mainly, and even in a limited way, soil erosion. And really what we're talking about is what is called here the resource management system plans as being the plans that we would want to see implemented on the Highlands Farms. So, because that would be the plan that would get to these issues that include water and the other resources, soil, water, air, that we need to get to in the Highlands. So, I think it's a great improvement that we have said that these plans are required for all clustered developments. I think we also ought to think about other thresholds that might kick it in, such as when you reach a certain percent of impervious cover in a farming operation, that kind of thing, that where you automatically kick in the requirement for a conservation plan. But the term that you used on the slide was a farm plan, which is a little inspecific, and the paper is very specific in talking about this resource management systems plans. So I think we are talking about the resource systems management plans, correct?
No, we're talking about the farm conservation.
Well, then we're going to make our own hybrid. We talked about this a little bit. Then we're talking about making our own hybrid with USDA input in order to have a plan that addresses water resources in the
Highlands. What we did was when we stood with it, but the work that Erica did when she was writing this white paper and working with Department of Ag and NRCS in looking at the plans and seeing what one would best meet the mission of the Highlands Council, and the two areas of focus. In fact, we actually were looking at focusing just on water, and it was Department of Ag actually said we think it should be soil and water, and we think that this plan is the best one, and it's the one that's implemented on farms that are preserved, and that this would be the best plan to meet the goals. So it is indeed the farm conservation plan and not the resource management systems plan that we are recommending would be put in place when you do these clusters.
But it would be a special Highlands brand of that, because according to the paper, the farm conservation plans don't address water.
The addition of the specific focus on water is what makes this an elevated action beyond what's normally done. Most farm conservation plans are soil oriented, they're single resource oriented. The addition of water is the critical function here. So what we're not getting some of the things that are in a resources management system plan, but we're getting the critical focus on water resources, water quality, water use, and that was our main intent here. So it is more than the norm.
So these plans we're going to work out with the USDA, I assume, or the NRCS, and I guess we're going to be talking about that. But this is a special sort of
special focus
brand of these plans. Okay. Yes. Because I think that's very much needed. And is that going to, where are those details going to be laid out and when?
We'll be working on those with Department of Ag and NRCS. And as you know, again, if this is the way you go, that's the next step, to work with them and make sure we have that process in place.
Well, I know we did talk about this a couple of years ago, I think at one of the TACs, but we're talking about doing this after adoption then?
Well, I think I think Monique could speak to it, but I think that they have it ready to go, so to speak, but Monique could better speak to it.
One of the concerns that I have is, you know, it is mentioned in here that now under the SADC, you have to have a farm conservation plan. But you're given a whole year after the closing in order to implement that. And we really, I would not support that. I think we, from the get-go, have to require these plans.
We require them. But again, if the chair is comfortable, maybe later with Monique speaking to it. But
I'd like to put that into the mix. Timing is very important. I don't.
So if we're moving sort of out of the traditional framework of the USDA plans, and we're hybridizing this to address the concerns that we have, why would we limit it only to soil and water? Why wouldn't we include the wildlife concerns?
Tim, could you speak up? I'm having trouble hearing.
I said, why wouldn't we include the wildlife concerns in particular in this management plan, since we're in hybrid world, so to speak, and not bound by the traditional operation of the program?
But would we be considering wildlife concerns on any project through other aspects of the Highlands plan?
Well, I guess I'll ask a question. Is that true to the extent that this preserved area falls under the agricultural provisions of the Act? I mean, is it in its nature, its fundamental nature, is it an agricultural operation, or is it agricultural lands occurring on lands that were preserved as part of a cluster development? And if it's, the latter, then we ought to seek to advance as many of our policies and goals as we can that strike the appropriate balance in allowing the agricultural to keep operating.
I think that's a good point, and the Resource Management Systems Plan specifically says in the white paper, soil, water, air, animals, and plants are addressed in those plans. So they are through the Cadillac, which is sort of what we've been going for in our plan, the Cadillac of these types of things. That's what Tim's saying. Well,
fortunately, New Jersey has a Department of Agriculture, so let's ask that week for so.
Talk to them while we can.
Right. Yes.
I know Ken Hardmeyer's here from the NRCS, too, so if he wants to add anything, that'd be helpful. I guess first and foremost, I wanted to say that the department is very supportive of the development and implementation of farm conservation plans. Some of the things I pointed out in the white paper were I thought it was important to clarify where these triggers initially came from, the triggers that were kind of last minute before the last draft plan was released. When we talked about the 3 and 9, which was basically focusing on ag development, creating a separate track, which the Highlands Act did do for agricultural-related development. So we have major development defined one way, agricultural development defined another way. We went with this trigger of if the ag impervious cover would increase by 3% or more, the farm conservation plan that addresses soil and water resources would be required. If the ag impervious cover increased 9% or more, then we went to the RMS plan. But what I wanted to say, first of all, this is very significant. These plans, as everyone knows, were completely voluntary up until the Highlands Act. So that's a huge step that we have made in terms of making these plans actually mandatory in the Highlands region of the state. Right now, it's based on the triggers. This particular proposal takes it to the next step, saying that, okay, if we have a cluster development and the remaining land is going to be in agricultural use, we want to require a conservation plan, even a higher standard than they preserve farm at this point, because it would have to address the soil and water resources on that parcel. We fully agree with that. We want to go on that approach. I'm a little concerned about the RMS plan being a requirement of just the ag parcel. I think we can continue to use those triggers. If there's going to be impervious cover added to that particular parcel, I would like to see that as an agricultural development, and then we use those three and nine triggers that would then say that if you're going to add a significant amount of impervious cover, to a, you know, above the 9%, for example, then we have the RMS plan back in play again. But I think that this is going to be a significant effort in the region. Have a farm conservation plan. We'd like to have one on every farm, and we want to talk about, you know, providing incentives and having cost sharing to make that happen. But I think as a first step, requiring the soil and water resources protected on the remaining ag parcel is the way to go. Look at anything that would happen on that particular farm that's related to the operation, obviously, to be agricultural development, and then we can go back to those triggers again. That the RMS plan would be required if there was going to be significant impervious cover added. That would be my suggestion. Other clarifications I had in the document were well, the soil, water, air, plants, and animals is the acronym of SWAPA. Clarifying that aquaculture, there's very little aquaculture in this region. I thought it might be a little misleading when we talk about aquaculture facilities and we're talking about CAFOs or confined areas. We only have, I think, 5 CAFOs in the entire state, and they're not located on islands. 2 of them are racetracks, actually, and one of them just went out of business. So I just wanted to be clear that there are very limited numbers of these types of things. The 2002 land use land cover, DEP defines something as a confined animal feeding operation. When they basically see a fence and a certain amount of acreage around it, they consider that a confined area, which is really not a correct identification of that operation. Other things were really just tweaking it in terms of this language tweaking, but those were my main concerns. Is I just didn't want it to seem like there was actually confined feeding operations throughout the Highlands, because that's not the case. And finally, the CREP program that's mentioned in here, actually. Participation in that program has really increased over the last few months. I think we got 19 applications in just last week. So I think the total acreage now is up over 500 acres. I know that's not huge. It's taken a while, but I think it's beginning to catch on. And, of course, we totally agree that the more conservation plans and federal programs that we can encourage to be implemented in the area, the better. And we're planning to work with NRCS and other partners to make sure that happens. So those are my suggestions. If anyone has any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
I have a question. According to the white paper, it's very seldom that the 3 and 9% are ever going to be triggered. So on most farms that are not converted to a cluster development, we're never going to see farm conservation plans through this time and effort.
Well, I don't think that's true because, first of all, as a starting point, we looked at ag development being the trigger, right, to actually trigger the need for a plan. I think it's also understood that it's actually a policy in the plan that we want to create incentive programs that all farms in the region create, that have farm conservation plans. So right now, the mandatory trigger would be if there's agricultural development taking place on the farm and it's going to hit certain triggers, then those plans would be required. We haven't seen a whole lot of agricultural development actually happening in the region, to be honest with you. So those plans haven't been triggered to date, but that does not mean that we don't want to have programs that incentivize the creation and the implementation of farm conservation plans.
Right. I certainly support that we keep those in place, but what about the idea, what do you think about the idea of lowering the threshold for the requirement of farm conservation plans on farms? In order to get more farm conservation plans in place, I mean, as it's made very clear here, that we do see the impacts, and we found this through the data that we've gathered for the RMP, that we see impacts from development.
You're talking about farms where there's no change in land use proposed.
No change in anything.
Or lower it, say 2%, 2%, or to get more farms requiring the farm conservation plans.
Well, I think
some development, but not no development, but some development.
Well, those triggers were established in the Act, and I think we should keep those triggers, but to do a voluntary incentive-based program, I fully support. I don't think we should lower the triggers, but I think we should look at other avenues of how do we get there. How do we partner with, for example, the New Jersey Water Supply Authority has done some work with some of the farms in the area. You know, how do we partner and incentivize the creation and implementation of these plans as opposed to, you know, making it more of a requirement? I just feel that that's just another, you know, load on the landowner that would be, you know, if they're not changing their land use and they're just doing what they're doing, I don't see why it should go any other track besides incentive-based approach to that.
One other question related to that. This 3% and 9% in the Act, presumably based on when we start seeing impacts. So if a cluster development is going in, shouldn't we count the impervious cover in that cluster development as when we do a calculation for what the total impervious cover is for the entire project, including the preserved land, in order to count when a resource management system plan is going to be required?
Well, I kind of look at it a little bit differently. I look at the ag parcel versus the residential cluster parcel. I look at the ag, remaining agricultural land as a kind of a separate unit. So, no, I wouldn't necessarily agree with that. But I do think the plan, having the plan requirement for soil and water protection on that ag parcel is a good way to go. I also wanted to clarify about flushing this out. The NRCS does have the farm conservation plans very flushed out. And like Tim mentioned, it was probably 3 years ago already when we talked to the subcommittee, the Natural Resources Subcommittee, and had a demonstration, had a presentation, I'm sorry, about exactly the things that are looked at in the conservation plans. I think you can see it's very extensive. The matrix that identifies, you know, the resource concerns under soil, water, air, plants, and animals is very significant. And actually, we just had a conversation, an ongoing conversation, but I think we're actually moving towards resolution with the DEP
on how we can actually even address stormwater concerns on a farm that's related to ag development in a conservation plan. So they can be extremely thorough. I think they really get to the goals that we're trying to achieve, which is resource protection. And I think they're a great vehicle for the farm community to continue to go in, you know, that direction. It just makes a whole lot of sense, and we support it. We just don't want to, you know, knowing resources, technical resources. Unfortunately, the Department of Ag actually had only two people, north and south, to do these types of plans. I think you know Dave Clapp, who works in the northern region here. We lost our South Jersey person. She just resigned recently. So this was a program that we were hoping to really beef up and use more and more, and now we find ourselves kind of losing resources. So I think we have to keep all of that in mind as we make decisions of what's mandatory, just due to limited dollars, limited resources as well. But the goal is, you know, have the plan, protect soil and water resources on that parcel next to the cluster, and we fully support that as an approach to take.
Thank you. Do you have a question for who you were supposed to
say? No, I heard what Marty said, so that's a question for her. But I just feel like we're a little off track in the sense that we went from a commission of cluster development to advancing farm management plants, which I would agree that the Act restricts us a purely agricultural operation where we can do that. And I think the acknowledgement that the thresholds that are in the Act are likely not to see those plans come into place, that the idea of incentivizing it you know, through these other programs that we've talked about over the last couple of years is a good approach to doing that. I do think that one of the pieces of that conversation we had with NRCS was the idea of whether or not those plans would be comparable to the RMP standards in terms of addressing the resources, and I'm not sure where that stands at the moment. But on the conversation about climate development, it seems that if you take a farm and you turn it into a major highlands development by putting 25,000 on whatever portion of it is, we move out of it, it's no longer an agricultural operation. So even if we farm the land in the perimeter of the cluster, it seems that it falls out of that, you know, strict definition of being an agricultural operation. And then I think the strictures of the Act are off, and we should talk about how do we manage and protect resources as well as the continued use of that land for agriculture. And that's my point about we shouldn't focus so narrowly just on soil and water, but the other resources that we're concerned about. But I think that's I hear that in this conversation we've had that over the last few years, that these are not farms with a cluster of houses on them. They are now housing developments with land around them that's being used for agricultural purposes.
But I do think that the resources would have to be protected on the residential side, you know, as a separate entity, really.
Yeah, but I think we're talking about a fairly tight envelope of building, and as Scott said, we then add in the idea of sending sewers into it. It's going to get really intensive. There's not going to be a lot of natural resources left in those building envelopes, by definition, because the cluster concept says you protect those resources that are around the outside of it. So I don't know that there's a lot of, you know, management work that's going to go on inside the building envelope in a cluster. I mean, maybe some minor stormwater management that has to be dealt with, but there's not going to be habitat left for anything else.
Well, sure there is, because we're going to save a lot just doing it that way.
In the outside.
We're going to be able to, right, but right. Within the actual focus, within the envelope of building,
right.
Yeah, but in terms of what you're protecting and preserving as a result of doing it in that way is significant.
Right, and I guess my point was that if you look at that donut around the building envelope as an agricultural operation, then the jurisdiction of the council to manage certain resources becomes more limited by the nature of the Act, as opposed as if you look at it as pertinent to a housing development, which we would then apply to all the RMP standards. So I just want to make sure that we're not framing it that way, because it would then, I think, hinder the right standard being put in place.
Thanks, Mike. Other comments? comments or questions?
We're not leaving clusters, right? We're just leaving that portion.
Other comments or questions on clusters? No, we're not leaving clusters.
Okay.
Sun hasn't set yet.
There's other issues in the R&D policies and objectives that I had questions about. Related to objective 2J4B, which lays out the conditions for cluster development served by public water supply, and then something similar where you talk about it in terms of wastewater. I still am a little confused. There has been a lot of clarification here, and I think it's good what you have done, but I'm still not absolutely clear about when an extension of an existing public water system and later when we talk about wastewater is allowed. Is it only within or immediately adjacent to an existing area served, or can we send sewer and water lines out in the countryside to serve agricultural cluster? Don?
The policy is immediately adjacent to or within the existing area served. You cannot have a leapfrog with a sewer line or a water line in between. If the area that where you want to cluster and is appropriate for clustering isn't right next to an existing area served, then it must be on an independent system.
Okay, so
a community on-site system.
So you can put clusters out, just not the sewers, with individual on-site systems.
That's right.
Okay, thank you.
What's your questions, comments?
Will this be subject to some kind of, possibility of reconsideration? Let's say it's not right next door, but it's within a block, sewer extensions. If it's,
I think the council would not stand for us having one that allowed for that kind of flexibility. I mean, it would. Okay, Tim?
Sounds good to me.
I think it's been very adjacent to or within, period.
Yeah, we even went with the term immediately adjacent to just clarify that point.
Just to make sure that's what we meant.
Right. Okay. Cheek by jowl, right?
We could add that too.
Right.
I actually went into dictionary.com to look up the term adjacent just to make sure that I knew all the definitions, and that's where the term immediately came from, because it wasn't in fact exactly clear.
I had a question about the change would be to the 90%. Mm-hmm. Housing would go on, the clustered housing would go on 10% when you have a sewer. What happens to that other 10%? Is it put under the care of homeowners association?
It would be part of the 90% set aside.
It would?
Now remember, that goal was very clearly set forth, that is a goal. And that's why we didn't actually say the 90%, because again, we looked at clusters across the nation to see what was the success rate. And so it is difficult to get to that, so what we did, we set that forth as a goal in sewer areas.
Every place where you mention that, I think if there could be a tweaking of the language a little bit to make it clear, maybe I was the only one that didn't get that, because you talked about 80% and then talked about 10% when you have sewers being the location of the clustered housing, then it made it sound like there was 10%.
Lost. Okay, we'll make that clear, because the goal is to get to the 10%, the remaining lands, rather than saying 90%, because again, it's a goal and feasible, etc.
Right.
So we'd say the remaining lands to be, and
that would, okay, that might do it.
I mean, but my, there's one. If you could have an environmentally sensitive area that is essentially surrounded by the developed envelope, where you wouldn't necessarily want to connect it to the other 80%, but you do want to preserve. So that would be outside of the sewer service area. It could be within the developed envelope. So that's part of the reason for not being absolutely definitive on this, because it's going to be site-specific.
Okay.
And all of these will be approved by the council directly. And this is a situation where the council does approve the creation of the cluster, as opposed to simply telling the municipality that it's okay.
Well, I guess in that instance, then, that environmentally sensitive area, you wouldn't want it farmed. You know, it might be a habitat you don't want to touch. But who was going to be responsible for protecting that then?
It depends on if it gets, we are in the cluster policy as opposed to the utility policy. If it gets connected to something that is preserved for open space, that's fine. It gets preserved as open space. It could wind up being within the community, if you will.
Right.
And then it would wind up being the responsibility of either a homeowners association or the municipality, whoever winds up owning the land.
If it were a conservation easement, most towns today take that easement in their own name as well as in the name of the state. So you have the municipality responsible as well as the homeowner who owned the property, homeowners association. So
you that we anticipated, Tracy, would be done as you approve it. That would be one of the considerations when you're approving that cluster.
It seems like it would be good for us to explicitly say that, or to that we want the municipality to be, you know, co-responsible or something. Because I mean, I know in my own town too, when these conservation areas are not managed by somebody, it's the same thing as we were talking about with the stormwater earlier. They're just not taken care of, and what was a habitat becomes somebody's lawn, and you know, it just happens.
Okay,
it's usually part of a condition of acquiring the easement in the first place.
Right, but then I'm talking about as time marches forward, 5 years down the road, you go back and you look at it in the field.
But it becomes part and parcel of the deed, so.
Yes.
Right. But it's still.
It's an
enforcement mechanism. We have Tom sort of put that in there for us in his meetings.
Just two clarification questions. One, in the. This is an objective 2J4A in terms of the extensions and the exceptions to that rule. You change the language to in the force is to avoid the taking of property without just compensation. I understand that's a concept, but there was more specific language we had in there. One on the granting of a waiver and when there's no minimum practical use. I guess the question that raises to me is when does that determination get made? Because regulatory takings claims are court decisions, not administrative decisions that we make.
We actually reverted back to the language from the statute. In the 07 draft, we used other language. We decided to be best to go back to the statutory language.
So this is the statutory language?
Yes.
And then I guess the other question is on 2K3C, we're talking about extending sewers for failing septic systems. There's a sentence hanging in the given that paragraph that says to address other issues of public health and safety, which are fairly nebulous.
That's a typo. That should be safety, comma, small s, such. To address
such
other
such needs shall have
the
highest
okay.
priority.
That's a typo.
That
makes more sense.
Yeah. Other comments, questions on this section? Policy? Okay, so we're ready to move on to water availability.
Sorry. Okay, we're on water and wastewater utilities, and it's the document that's titled Water Supply and Wastewater Utilities Service Area GPOs. And the other document we gave you is directly from the 2007, just for comparison. And it's subpart D, Sustainable Development and Water Resources. So that's just for comparison, because in this document what we did is we give you a sort of a guide to show you where there are changes, no changes, and to pull you back to the 2007 document so you can follow this. What we've done here, and the first utility GPOs we're going to talk to is because we've just talked about clusters. These are the ones that refer to clusters. The objectives 2J4B and 2K3D have been revised to recognize the different potential for resource protection for the septic system clusters, that's the 80% minimum, and sewered clusters. And that's where we have that goal to get to the cluster development on 10%. the preserved acreage also obviously no less than 80%. Sorry, you want me to go ahead? Okay. And this was Tracy was referring to the next bullet. You can have protected areas, for example, environmental resource areas on the sewer lots with deed restrictions to meet that 10% threshold. Thresholds apply to project area, all parcels affected by the clustering proposal, whether using municipal TDR, non-contiguous clustering, contiguous clustering, or single parcel. And that was just to make sure that in this case you could, if you think back to that Mansfield WQMP we're looking at, if you can do clusters using, you could take the protect the valley there and move the cluster to the sewered area into the WQMP. That was a goal there that we had discussed. And so this was to refer to that, to make sure that we understood project area were all the parcels affected, not just where the exact site. Cluster examples on septics and sewers within the conservation zone. And this goes back to another question asked earlier about why the change here. And we just gave some examples. If you had 200 agricultural acres and the septic system density was one dwelling unit per 10 acres, on septics you would be preserving 160 acres with 40 acres available for the 20 development units, which means one development unit each 2 acres. Now, that's your 80% there. But if you were looking at sewers, you'd preserve at least 160 acres. At least 20 of the remaining 40 acres deed restricted as part of the developed parcels or attached to the 160 acres. But the effective housing density there would be one dwelling unit an acre, which is still low for sewer development. But that's why we looked at the differing approach, because there is greater potential under sewer development to tighten that and preserve more. Farm conservation plan applies in both situations. It's just being very clear again, consistent with our white paper and the policy for the farm conservation plan focused on soil and water resources.
Thanks. Mr. Chairman, I asked, so are we setting up a, maybe someone help me with the economics of this. I just find it hard to imagine private developers or even municipalities paying for extension of sewer lines, which is very expensive, and not being able to recoup that capital investment through the density. So we have a sense about, as you acknowledge here, that that's never pursued development. And while it may be appropriate to have the higher density development up against the existing community zone, when we start talking about undefined extensions out into the commercial land.
Well, this again, what we talked about amongst the staff was utilizing different methods here to better utilize the sewer area. And again, the greatest example of that was the Mansfield project, because they there had the sewer, which was for one unit for 3 acres, and they had an optional cluster opportunity there. But they were proposing and did propose extension of sewer, one unit for 3 acres. In that kind of a case, you could use cluster development, you could use TDR, and you could maximize that sewer area, and it would be better utilized in that way. So we see the opportunity, but here we're limited to what we said we were using these clusters to do, and that gets back to taking the development that could occur based on the thresholds of the plan and moving it. And that limits us there under sewer, and we accept that. So we'd look to see if we could maybe use TDR or something else there as well.
Right. I guess my concern is the conundrum we're creating for ourselves is that the main focus of the policy is to allow the sewers to be extended out away from adjacency to the existing community. And then we're trying to reconcile our other desires, which is to keep the density and the character of that development more in line with the surrounding environments. Mm-hmm. And we're creating a box where, you know, as I've said all along, it's much more logical to have a higher density development and the sewer extensions explicitly limited to logical extensions of the existing community zone rather than, even if it's on a cluster pattern.
So, was that suggesting that this situation is unlikely to arise very often?
Being the environmentalist that I am, what I see is a lot of pressure then when somebody comes in and say, well, you guys say your primary policy is about all that cluster that development.
but I need to get X number of units there in order to justify it, and then we get into pressure to waive the standards. And, you know, and that's, there's numerous examples out there that that development kind of stuff happening, so.
And this gets back to us being very clear, again, and it was back to Bill's question about what exactly are we proposing here, and we are not proposing bonus densities.
If I may also recognize that in the RMP as it's written right now, in the agricultural resource area, cluster shall happen. It's not may. It's not incentive. It's not, it's mandatory that if you're going to develop, if you're going to have a subdivision, you shall cluster. You shall cluster either on septic systems or on infrastructure. The real issue is can we get municipalities to pre-plan the clusters so we get more sensible clustering. The economic issue, if you're extending from an existing area served into a directly adjacent area, that's actually fairly low cost, and compared to putting in septic systems, it's probably a no-brainer from that perspective. But we don't want it on 3 acres. We want it on a smaller amount of a smaller lot size, because then that's an efficient use of the infrastructure. The real issue gets to the creation of a new community on-site wastewater system that is distant from an existing area served. And actually, I just had the opportunity to talk to some folks down at the New Jersey Water Environment Association conference who do this business, and it's gotten down to the point where they feel that a 20-unit development is economically feasible on these systems, on the community on-site systems. And that's half the total size that I was used to several years ago. So it's really getting cost-effective.
And how big an area would that kind of system?
What we're talking about here is if you had 20 units, you'd be pulling those 20 units in from 200 acres in the conservation zone, roughly, and it would fit on 20 acres or less. And the odds are, if you went down to two-thirds acre lots, that would allow you to put your 20 units in and have room for the septic system, the leaching field, the probably treatment plant. So you'd have to figure it in. You might not get all, you might not get it down to exactly 10% of the total project area. You might have 15% or something like that. But that's what you're looking at a site specific basis. You'll at least get your 20% reserve. You may get significantly better than that.
Are these maintained by a homeowners association, or is it
some
kind of utility?
Yeah, the idea behind these, and it's in the utility policy somewhere, I'd have to hunt for it again. You do not want these things operated by homeowners associations. You want them operated by professionals, and that's all there is to it.
So they would come under the management of the municipality?
It could do that, or frankly, there are EPU regulated entities that manage a number of these things around the state. They're perfectly good at it. They charge the residents a fee just like any other utility, and so it works just fine. But you have to make sure that you're not having a situation where the homeowners own and are responsible for these facilities, because that just does not work.
Bill?
Yeah, just a comment. I mean, you know, going down to 3/4 of an acre in a cluster or whatnot pretty much flies in the face of a lot of what municipalities want to see in their community. So if you're looking for cooperation in that regard, let me assure you it won't happen. They're not interested in clustering in higher density, particularly out in this region, because people who move here aren't interested in living close together. So you have to look at the lifestyle factor regardless of the science. So I think if you get below, much below an acre, I think you're going to have pushback. Or this could be part of Commissioner Doria's affordable housing inclusionary zoning aspects, where you can build your co-housing, which will probably not provide for the on-site treatment cost factor of that. I can just see, you go to a municipality that's got a model land to preserve, you're going to say to them, well, okay, we're going to let you transfer it in, we're all going to put it on 3/4 acre, it's all going to go in this area, and they're going to say to you, you know what, let them build 1 to 25, let them build 1 to 10. And they're not going to encourage it. You'll see your clustering ordinances go out the window.
With all due respect to that comment, I have a homegrown example, contrary to what you suggest. And you know, not that you're wrong, but I think that people want to live here. And if you can create a clustered development that is also akin to preservation and has that benefit, and it's in a nice rural, semi-rural community, people will want to live there.
I would agree with you, Jack.
They'll appreciate the cluster.
I would agree with you, Jack.
Appreciate the cluster on 3/4 of an acre. It'll create a neighborhood for their children to play. The school bus won't have to travel all over the place and pollute the roads. It'll go to a local place. And I've seen this happen in my own town, which has been very keen for a long time on large lot zoning. That's the way we developed. But we have 3/4 of an acre in a major development. I think it has now 86 single-family homes on it. And the prices on that development started at about, well, of course, this was 15 years ago, but they started at in the neighborhood of $100,000, and they're bumping up against $1 million now on 3/4 of an acre. And the homes turn over at a tremendous rate because it is among the most affordable places to live and have that address. I think that's really very important. So
I agree with Jack. I think the key there is if you design it properly.
Yes.
I think what we see too many times is the cow pasture turned into the track development. And you're right. If it's designed well, it'll work. But it will take some selling. And I'm sure that didn't come across easy with the first proposal.
Absolutely, it did not, especially because the package plant was not a was a chemical treatment plant rather than the other kind of plant. And so it's very expensive. That's been a concomitant cost that has increased it, but it doesn't seem to affect the value.
I have a question.
Yes.
Back to Tim's point about, and I agree with that, I think in the real world what will happen is once you start sewering these areas, there's going to be tremendous pressure from the developer, landowner, municipality, whatever, to far, far exceed the density. And I'm wondering, while again, that's what's going to happen in the real world, notwithstanding what's happening with the COA regulations that are proposed and other factors, what does our policy, I don't know if it's a policy or an objective, say relative to that point of mind? What is the language that limits or provides for exceptions to these densities? I'd like to see how it's proposed that that's controlled.
We don't have exceptions to the densities. The densities were based on what could be developed on the land, not on bonus density. We didn't have exceptions for that.
So what is the policy? What if I want to look at something to see if it's just objective
specifically
2K4B and 2K3D?
You're asking specifically in terms of clustering, Debbie?
Cluster examples on septic. Yeah, I guess it would be on the clustering within the conservation zone. Because there should be something in place to safeguard, and if it's another one of these prohibit except, and then it's a amorphous exception without any standards, then Tim's point is well taken, that there will be no safeguards.
Well, can I just, in the interest of time,
yeah.
Chair, can I just take it that we have to show you the language okay. that limits this to no exceptions, no bonus densities, and give you that one.
Okay, that would be great.
Okay.
Other comments on this?
On this whole section?
Yeah.
Yeah, I had a couple of questions, comments. On page 4, we're talking about under policy 2B7, then we have the objectives that go with that. Objective 2B7B, just a question. So we do have the authority to review these New Jersey DEP water allocation decisions, correct? That's the one that says that we shall ensure, that DEP shall ensure that any new or increased water allocation permits do not result in significant reductions in safe yields. Are we going to review that, or we're just stating positively that New Jersey DEP will ensure? I mean, It's we don't usually use that.
That would come up with that and tell me to do that.
And the act requires it for DEP, and what we had discussions with DEP in terms of our providing consistency determinations to them.
Okay, so that's ironed out. DEP agrees with this objective, is what you're saying.
We're all looking at each other. We were all at the meeting, so that's.
But that's a good question. So, just to be clear, so if we make a recommendation, in this, is this a case where if we make a recommendation to DEP, it's a binding recommendation?
Well, it's a statutory requirement that's in the water allocation statute.
Okay, thank you. Under the next objective there, which is 2H2A, prohibit land uses that have significant potential to result in discharge of pathogens, and then we talk about what can be done in Tier 1 wellhead protection area. Are we going to put in monitoring wells or anything around these tier 1 areas? Because it seems, I have a concern that we really should be saying these pathogens should be allowed in Tier 2 or Tier 3. I mean, the tiers are really based on how, isn't it, based on the travel time between the roof and reaching the water source. So, number one, why don't we make it Tier 2 or 3 rather than Tier 1? And then how are we going to make sure that if we go with Tier 1, it's effective? Are we going to have monitoring wells, like shallow wells, that would monitor pathogens?
With regard to Tier 1, for pathogens, the policy or the objective is to prohibit. So there's no need to monitor what isn't there, and that's really what you're after. The reason for Tier 1, and I should explain this for the council, Tier 1 is a two-year time of travel from the outer band of it into the well. And it is unique among the tiers in that pathogens have an attenuation. And so the two-year time of travel was established through DEP based on research showing that viruses and bacteria that are pathogenic attenuate in that period of time and simply don't reach the well. And so there's no need to apply that policy to the prohibition to tiers 2 and 3 because they exceed that time of travel.
Dan, is that based on a certain assumed pumping rate?
No, the greater the pumping rate, the faster the water flow would be, and therefore the broader Tier 2 or Tier 1 would be. So the size of Tier 1 is dependent on the aquifer and the pumping rate of the well.
Okay.
So yes, it does address that issue.
Okay, that's a good answer. As far as requiring a construction of sewer lines within Tier 1, why don't we not allow that at all? Why would we just, prevent it?
Because in some cases you're going to wind up with a sewer line that needs to cross Tier 1 in order to get from here to there, and to go around is going to be problematic. But you can build sewer lines so that they have essentially no exfiltration, no movement of water across. Florida uses this within their wellhead protection areas, has for decades, very shallow wells, very prolific aquifers, easy movement of groundwater. They use this policy and they found that it works.
I know I am familiar with the paper in Pennsylvania talking about these lines going in hard rock geology as opposed to the sandy soils of Florida. And this USGS paper says it's absolutely impossible to do that in this region because of the hard rock geology and the settling and the fractures and the changing of fractures. And I just think we should revisit that, and I think that it may be true in Florida where you have a uniform bed.
Well, actually, they have karst.
All right. Well, whatever. that's not uniform at all.
Yeah.
But I can pass that paper on. But I mean, I think that USGS has done research that shows that it's over time basically impossible to build a sewer line that's not going to leak, and that's part of the problem that we have with the infiltration as well as exfiltration on our water lines and our sewer lines. So I think we ought to just prohibit it. We're talking about new lines going in, so why can't we go around? And these wellhead areas are not that big. So it's just a matter of preventing, ounce of prevention.
Let me ask you, though. Can't septic systems leach out and be an even greater potential you know, harm to a water system?
Well, there is separation distances. Well, go ahead, Dave.
Yeah, that's the objective very specifically says we don't want septic systems in Tier 1.
Right.
Absolutely.
So we're better off if there's anything going to take place in that tier to have the sewers.
But I'm talking about a sewer line crossing the wellhead protection area, Tier 1.
The question is, if that area is developed and it's not developed on septic systems and it has to be sewered, and therefore what do you do? So if you simply say, well, there shall be no development in Tier 1,
I'm just saying the pipe should move, though.
Well, if you're going to have development that isn't on septic systems, you're going to have pipes.
I'm talking about avoiding just the Tier 1.
Well, that's what I'm saying. If you are saying no development, no residential development, for instance, in Tier 1, that would eliminate both the need for septic systems and for sewer pipes.
Why don't you get to the USGS paper to Dan?
Yeah, because I don't.
Next step, please.
I'm sorry, I don't get that. I don't agree with that. Okay, that's all I had.
Okay. Other comments?
Utility GPOs and preservation area. 2.1 consolidates preservation area provisions for water and wastewater that prohibit extensions or new infrastructure unless exempt or NJDEP waiver approved. That is consistent with the Highlands Act. And clarifies that where waivers are approved, the project should maximize protection of sensitive environmental resources.
Is there something against the, you added the word designated to 1A?
No, I'm sorry.
And the objective?
That's basically from the statutory provision that all designated sewer service areas in the preservation area are revoked unless they are pipes in the ground or unless they're exempt or they're waived.
Okay, so is there a difference between, is designated synonymous with historic or existing as opposed to new? I'm just asking why the word was added.
Designated is tied to the water quality management planning process where they designate sewer service areas.
So that's you pull those back.
Right. So in this case, we're saying the designated must match the existing unless you get a waiver or you're
exempt. And that applies to, the policies also get a point of the going forward, right? So it's sort of clear. Clarification was to settle the question about whether or not there were expansions in sewer service areas in the preservation area.
That would be through waiver.
Only through waiver.
Yeah, consistent with the act. Okay, utility goals, policies, objectives, resource protection. Objectives 2J4A and 2K3C clarify infrastructure limits in protection and conservation zone and environmentally constrained subzone. And they're prohibited except for exempt projects, waivers allowed by the Act, and council-approved cluster development. But in that case, the cluster must avoid the sensitive environmental resource or resources such as open water buffers, riparian areas, streets, slopes, critical habitat, forested portions of forest resource areas, and agricultural lands of agricultural resource areas. And utility goals, policies, and objectives regarding water quality, public health and safety waiver, the language in the following objectives 2J3, 2J4A, and 3K3C clarify the public health and safety issues. Protection of domestic wells in clusters, objectives 2J4D and 2K3F were revised to further emphasize best management practices and cluster design to minimize potential for well water quality problems. These again are in response to comments received. That's it.
Questions, comments? No questions, no comments? Okay. Are you ready to turn to public comments?
I'm ready.
Okay, so. Anyone who hasn't spoken to the council before would like to speak? Okay. Anyone who has spoken would like to speak? Sir. Sure.
Good afternoon. Ross Kushner, representing the Quantic River Coalition. Let's be frank. The policy of conditional availability is designed to let developers keep developing in areas of water deficit. If we really wanted to correct the water deficit, there are a lot of inexpensive ways to do that without allowing new development. It was dreamed up by the big developers. It's being championed by their mouthpiece on the council, who is Jack Schreier, and that's the way it is. The environmental community and the public, in hundreds and hundreds of comments, have been saying the same thing. Stop the growth in the water deficit areas, in part because we don't believe that 125% mitigation is achievable. Now, Eileen Swan says the staff is responding to these comments, but their answer to people who don't believe 125% is achievable is to raise the standard to 200%. Now, true to form, they're supporting this with a new document, and I see this document riddled with the same false statements we've seen in the past. For example, they say if the recharge methods are appropriate for stormwater developed by the DEP, then they're appropriate for the deficit mitigation. Yet for stormwater, the requirements are far less. They only need to compensate one for one for loss of recharge due to new impervious cover. Here they must account for the new impervious cover, plus all water uses, domestic uses, and they have to raise the bar to 125 to 200%. So it's a much greater standard. It is not the same. And to put this in the document as equivalent is a false statement. It's deceiving the public. I was recently on a panel with Lisa Jackson, DEP commissioner. She was asked flat out, is this policy a good policy? She said, no, it's a bad policy and it's bad science. I mean, I don't know who you have to hear it from to believe it. It's time that this council stop nibbling around the edges, listen to the public, and fix this plan, make real substantive changes to this plan. I'm very pleased to see Tahisha Way, Debbie Pascarelli, who I wish I could clone, Tim and Tracy, raising the issues that need to be raised today, but you know, more of them need to step up to the plate. I mean, I hope those of you with constituents, that your constituents are paying attention, like Bill Cogger here, to what he's doing. He's selling them out to the developers. And I don't know how else to say it. But we need to be honest about this. We need to recognize that we're in two camps now, the ones that wanted the developers to keep on developing, and the ones who are taking their responsibility under the Highlands Act seriously. We're in the end game, and we need to get serious about this. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sir? Elliot Rugen, New Jersey Highlands Coalition. I'll keep this brief because for some reason the air in here feels like I've been on a 12-hour flight in the center seat and coach. At last week's council meeting, the very last item of the RMP discussion, staff suggested a fundamental change in the very nature of the Highlands Regional Master Plan, a change that, if approved, would modify the RMP's relevance to the entirety of the planning area and brings into question the overall necessity of a regional plan. A clear challenge to the Council's commitment to following its mandate under the Highlands Act. Specifically, staff had recommended that septic density thresholds in the RMP will not be used for water quality management plan consistency determinations for non-conforming municipalities. In the final draft RMP, if adopted without modification to this section, the Council retains authority in the entirety of the Highlands region, whether in the preservation or planning area, blind to the line, as it were, to determine whether a municipality or county WQMP is consistent with the RMP. If found to be inconsistent, the council can request DEP require a WQMP be resubmitted until consistency with the RMP is achieved. The nitrate dilution model, as proposed in the November 2007 draft technical addenda, is specific to each LUC zone. The technical addenda is very detailed as to the scientific basis, precedents, and the sound principles that justify the model. This surprising and fundamental change in direction to abandon the LUC zone-specific septic density thresholds in WQMP consistency determinations for non-conforming municipalities leaves little else in the council's quiver to adopt an effective regional master plan. It is a significant component of planning authority you claim in the planning area. To abandon this authority will only discourage municipal conformance by granting greater flexibility as a benefit for nonconformance. The plan then defeats itself by becoming meaningless in the planning area. Last week, the chairman had asked us for a straw poll among the council, asking members for a show of hands if they accepted the staff's recommendation. Six council members raised their hand, not a majority, fortunately, and albeit a non-binding poll. However, what is most unsettling is that in later discussions with members, with our members and staff, that staff had with council members, that our members and our staff had with council members, revealed varying opinions about precisely what it was they were voting on, and equally a varied degree of comprehension as to the implications of the staff recommendations. Whatever cliche you prefer, the rubber hits the road, the pencil hits the paper, now is the time to take absolute ownership of this plan. It is, after all, you who will be held accountable as this plan's authors. Don't forget the 5.7 million people in New Jersey who drink Highlands water are counting on you. Now is the time to reinforce that each of you is indeed the most qualified person in this state to represent our interests. Thank you.
Thank you. Other comments?
This is my first council meeting. I didn't get up to court. I wanted to see how it was done. And I want to thank you all for all your continued work on this, although it wasn't quite as tedious and boring as I anticipated. But
try us again in 2 weeks.
For you, this is a lot. It's a lot of work, and I wish we were paying you, actually. I did want to just respond.
Here's one thing about how it's done, so you introduce who you are.
Oh, good idea. Okay. Christine Hepburn. I'm affiliated as an individual with on the board of the Highlands Coalition, New Jersey Highlands Coalition. I'm a Madison resident, but I'm a U.S. Fish and Wildlife land steward partner on land in Hardwick, and I'm looking to buy land in the Highlands to be a steward and protect it. I'm waiting till the end of this process to see what land I want to buy that's vulnerable, and it's clear there's going to be plenty of vulnerable land to be purchased and protected in the end. I just wanted to respond to Councilmember Schreier's remark that we groaned. I was definitely a groaner in the one big consensus groan. It was not in response that developers were evil. It was specifically the response to the question, who is going to certify that the mitigation is working to get the CO? And the response was, well, it could be an engineer of the developer. And that was the groan. And that's not a put down of anybody to suggest that it makes a difference who's paying you. Anybody who's been to a planning board or zoning board hearing knows. So you don't need to know who the engineer is working for. You just have to listen to what he's saying. It may be scientific, but it's very clear what side engineers are testifying for. And that's just human nature. No one's going to see a problem or a danger that their livelihood requires that they not see. And I applaud the skepticism that I've observed here among some members. I hope you get more. I want to second Ms. Carluccio's suggestion that in the water deficit areas, you start out with no development until there's some mitigation proven. And that's it for now. Thank you.
Thank you.
David Shope, and the last commenter made a good point. It is important who pays you. And I want to know who pays Dillingham, and I want to know who pays Carluccio. I just got a annual report from the Middlesex Water Company. Middlesex Water Company gets 60% of its water from the New Jersey Water Supply Authority. Its return on investment last year was 8.9%, down a little bit from over 9% the year before. But of course, one of the reasons for that is salaries went up. Mr. Dahl, who's the CEO of Middlesex Water Company, earned $397,532 in compensation last year. That works out to $1,089 every day. Sundays, Saturdays, holidays, every day. While I was doodling, I did Corzine's reported income of $11.2 million, and he earns $30,685 every day. So you're making Mr. Dahl reasonably wealthy, and Mr. Corzine was wealthy when he came into the job. The concept of a water deficit is a fraud. Do the math. The math is simple. I use conservative numbers of 44 inches per year of precipitation. Throw half of that away for transport evaporation, you're down to 22 inches per year. The average person, according to New Jersey DEP, consumes 63 gallons per day. The rest you can figure out for yourself. It works out to the fact that each acre of land anywhere in New Jersey can support six people. Water deficit in my eye. What a bunch of baloney. What we really have here is a colonial policy. We have a policy where Van Ab says the only water that's being considered is the water that is not reserved for the cities for by reservoirs. Well, that includes, of course, the watersheds to the reservoirs. We get what water falls in the cracks, literally. This is a colonial policy. You are the colonial administrators. That's all there is to it. And I've been noticing the language that is used by some members, virtually in every sentence. It includes manage, require, prohibit, conformance, and mandatory. This is the language of a dictatorship. That's what it is. And also, over 1 million gallons a day goes from the New Jersey Water Supply Authority to golf courses outside the region. According to the DEP's own documents, and I encourage you to get a copy of permit number 5033, 12% water leakage is considered normal. 12% of water leakage for Elizabethtown Water alone equals the equivalent usage of 500,000 New Jerseyans. And we're worried about a drop here and a drop there. This is the most absurd policy I've seen in a long time. It could be only explained by the fact that this area is a colony. Thank you.
Thank you. Sylvia Kovacs, Warren County. As a former member of a municipal land use board whose township is split between the preservation area and the planning area, I'd like to offer some comments with regard to the clustering of exemptions. As per page 107 of the final draft regional master plan, the Highlands Act, quote, the Highlands Act outlines 17 exemptions by which an activity would not be bound by the Highlands Act, NJDEP's rules for the Highlands Preservation Area, the regional master plan, and any municipal master plan or development regulations that are conformed to the regional master plan. Thousands of acres throughout the region could be developed under the exemptions. The exemptions are a method for landowners to use their properties where limited by the Highlands Act, but the exercise of these exemptions could result in further impacts to the region's ecosystems and water supply areas. Therefore, the regional master plan addresses the need to develop programs that attempt to avoid these impacts, such as preservation through green acres or state agricultural development committee, cluster type development, intra-local government transfers of development rights, and economic incentives, end quote. Following up on comments submitted during the public comment period about the clarification of the clustering provisions in this final draft RMP, It is my assumption that the goal of the council in drafting policies, objectives, and standards for clustering is to achieve the dual objective of preserving large contiguous tracts of farmland and forest, but also to, as required in the Act, avoid, quote, scattered and piecemeal, end quote, development. This goal is clearly enunciated in the above quotation from the final draft RMP. Unfortunately, in the program's implementation and conformance sections of the final draft RMP, it is not emphasized, nor is it clear, how municipalities should address these scattered automatic rights to develop. In that context, I urge the Council to establish standards that municipalities be required and provided with an incentive to create an intra-municipal transfer program as provided for in the MLUL 40:55D-137 et sec, exclusively devoted to the transfer of exempt development rights in the sending area to more suitable locations and areas of compact center development in the municipality in the receiving area. One point that I'd like to make to revisit and to get clearly stated. During the discussion about the water deficit and the chart on page 2 of the paper, Water Deficit Policy Options, it was first stated that the chart at the top of page 2 was current data. However, then Dan mentioned it was 2003 data. I contend that there has been an enormous amount of development since 2003, so the council is starting out with, quote, old, not current deficit information, and that you start with false quantitative assumptions. I would suggest respectfully that that inconsistency be addressed as the council moves forward with regard to the discussion of allowing further development in water deficit areas and its discussions and thought processes with regard to the mitigation plans. One point with regards to the Mansfield WQMP, if I might just reiterate again for the public, not only is that project that brought that WQMP before this council not in a sewer service area, it is not even in a proposed sewer service area. It was not listed as a proposed SSA that Mansfield just recently submitted as part of its WMP to the DEP. Also, the treatment facility that would be required for that development is in the preservation area, and that cannot be expanded. One final point, I would just like to take this opportunity to state to the council and share with the general public that as a Warren County resident, I am most grateful to the New Jersey Planning Organization for having recognized our Warren County representative and Highlands Council member Debbie Pasquarelli with their 2008 Achievement Award. Having sat on a planning board myself, I appreciate the depth of knowledge and practical experience that Debbie continually brings to the thought processes of not only her township as a former mayor and planning board member, but also as a member of our Warren County Planning Board. I congratulate the NJPO for having recognized Debbie's contribution, and I am grateful for the practical experience that Debbie brings to this council in its work to develop an RMP that will truly implement the Highlands Act. I thank the council.
Thank you. We're very proud of Debbie for that, and also note that our executive director, Eileen Swan, is a past recipient of that award as well. Other comments?
Julia Thomas, New Jersey Highlands Coalition. I had sent out an email to our members that today's agenda was huge in caps and meaty, and you certainly have lived up to my expectations. We obviously have to have an opportunity to go and review all the policies and programs and documents that you've handed out today, but I just have a couple of observations. I think we have spoken to almost every one of you about our concerns about the 125% mitigation proposal. We still have those concerns. We recognize that you are trying to address those concerns. But I think that the process that you're coming up with, its implementation, its monitoring, you know, trust but verify, we're concerned that you not rely on exclusively on modeling assumptions. So there has to be verification of this trust if you're going to go forward with this. It's still a really complicated process. And I think that's why you heard the concerns being, and spent so much time on this issue. And the more complicated it gets, the more likely it is to fail. Mitigation in New Jersey, mitigation programs have a dismal history. And please do not add one to that history.
We appreciate the more conservative thresholds that you're proposing in these programs, but we encourage absolutely the use of the water use and conservation management plans that you're proposing to develop and implement. We think that those also need trust and verification before you assume that they have been successful and you decide that there is new water available, that you've been successful, that there's new water available and you can go back to development in those HUC 14s. Just a couple of comments on cluster. You had a diagram of clustering the clusters, and it was comforting to hear Dan Bernas talk about the fact that you shall cluster. Please, and I'm not sure, maybe there is something in there, but if you can require that the clustering of the clusters happen during the conformance process, the planning to cluster the clusters take place in the conformance process. Obviously, you're talking about either an intermunicipal or larger TDR program to make that happen, but it really is extremely important. And then I have one other concern. Clustering will result in land that, yes, you want it to continue in agriculture, but many of these lands in the conservation zone have environmental constraints. They are, they have environmental issues on them. I'm very concerned that because you have reduced the size of the farm, that those environmentally constrained areas will, their integrity will be compromised by agricultural practices in the future. And if there is something that can be done to make sure that they are protected in some way going forward as part of the deed restriction or whatever, that would be very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Dave Pfeiffer. I'm a Highlands Project Director for the Association of New Jersey Environmental Commissions. I have two relatively brief comments today, and I'm sure you're relieved to hear that. The first one is a general comment about the kinds of management systems you're creating in the plan. ANJEC is very concerned about adequate delivery of control systems that the council is building into the plan. A good example is a discussion today of development in deficit areas. It looks to be a fairly elaborate system to implement and maintain over a long period of time. The complications arise from the initial assumption that some development needs to be allowed, and there may be advantages to doing that. Once that fork in the road is taken, then those systems that are of the type that are being proposed are an absolute necessity. So I think the council needs to ask itself very honestly, does it have the staffing, the funding, and the will to implement those kinds of systems over a protracted period of time? That is something that is an overarching consideration for the RMP. Better to make a clear distinction at the beginning than to write a check you cannot cash in terms of providing controls. Secondly, on the subject of clustering, I'm very interested in the clustering of the clusters provision, and I understand that you would intend to do that through the conformance process of by municipal planning. What is confusing is what is allowed to be clustered. We began with an on-lot clustering approach, and that's a fairly simple way of looking at things. Then we expanded it to non-contiguous clustering. Then there's a policy that seems to allow the use of exemptions being moved into the clusters. And then finally, there's mention of using TDR to arrange development in clusters. All of these things really do complicate the mix, But the important issue that I think came to my mind today is that under your RMP and under the Act, the receiving zones for TDR are voluntary. And now you have a mandatory clustering provision proposed in the conservation zone, which would allow TDR to be used within it. So are you now saying that in order to achieve conformance, a municipality must have a clustering plan that would allow TDR and therefore require the designation of an involuntary receiving zone? So I think you need to think that one through a little more. With regard to the impervious surfaces issue and the triggers for the different types of agricultural management plans, I think it's very clear that you need to consider the entire imperviousness of the resulting project, not just the imperviousness on the farm as the trigger. You don't have to be constrained by the Act's limits on the 3% and 9% impervious surfaces when you are creating, in effect, a development project. And I think Mr. Dillingham's comments in that regard were right on the money. So that's my observation for today. Thank you. Thank you.
Helen Heinrich, last but not least again. Very glad to see some of the language in the cluster changes. As you all know, this is a very significant issue for the farm community because it is, we see, the only way that some of the land value could possibly be tapped on July 17th. It's going to take a lot of work to make other feasible ways of preserving farmland. So this is possible. On the other hand, we don't see very many farmers considering this option. And I'm going to give you a copy of a little checkoff list that I prepared because there's about 8 or 10 major, expensive, difficult steps before that project even gets back to you, where, again, it can go through an entire site plan review. Farmers are dubious about whether they want these projects on their land. They're very concerned, however, about large lot zoning being the result of your plan conformance process and where those exceptions are going to go, and hopeful that there'd be some way to concentrate them in a cluster. If the cluster can be on somebody else's farm and use my density, it's even more acceptable than putting it on my farm. But it's even the EPA says that from a regional standpoint, water quality is your concern. Concentrating the density, and they do talk about clusters in their research, which I have back here, is the only way to really do it on a regional basis. And the way we see this is that there are going to be individual soil tests up front that are going to determine whether or not this is an idea at all on this property. Nitrate tests. And if so, where it's to go, and if so, what kind of wastewater treatment might be appropriate. And I'm continually impressed with how much control you all have down the road, that if somehow, through some miracle, this one gets to this point and someone objects to it, it'll be up in front of you with all the details and all the tests and possibly even more tests, and you have a chance to weigh in on it at that point. So we look for your support for keeping the concept there, because that gives a little extra value if the farmer wants to sell a farm to a farmer, whether or not it's ever exercised. It gives you a little extra value. So it's really important to keep it in there, but we fully understand that it's going to be decided on a very difficult site-specific basis. And in terms of farm conservation plans, they are extensive, and they are hard to live up to. If you have a preserved farm, you're required to do a farm conservation plan. The reason it says within a year is because you get at the bottom of the list for the assistance from NRCS. So there's no way a farmer can maybe even get one in a year, depending on the availability of staff. And if you have a preserved farm, you must have it within a year. It does get monitored by the CADD, and it should be implemented. I think the farm community feels that there should be more insistence that it be implemented. But regardless of whether you have these clusters, you've got these conservation plans that are going supposedly going on the farms. The whole discussion of mitigation is interesting. I was impressed with the attempt to get a little more information before you about the degrees, the scales that we're talking about here, and to say that to throw everything out for way less than 1% deficit, when the deficit may be just because you're sending your stormwater or something to another HARC. A mapping question, not a scientific deficit. It seems like taking the easy way out and saying absolutely no development at all kind of makes you wonder whether, you have any job to do at all. And your job is really to create balance and get better water conservation and water quality improvement. Thanks.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask a question?
So let me see if there are other people who want to speak first. Sorry. I think this, yeah.
Wilma Fry, New Jersey Conservation Foundation. I just have a couple of brief things. I wanted to also bring up, as the first speaker did, the issue that arose last week, which had to do with whether the council would include in its review of wastewater management plans the septic density standard that has been developed in the draft in the RMP. And I wanted to continue to urge the council to include that in its recommendations in both to the Somerset County Planning Agency and in any other case where this issue would arise. Just speaking on a slightly more personal note about this, in Hunterdon County where I live, the council's urging the recommendation of their, consistency with your standard would really help Hunterdon County municipalities that are in the Highlands. There was a group called the Seven Towns Group, which fought to try to get the state planning areas changed from planning area 2 to planning area 4 and 5. And those municipalities would find that the council recommendation could really help them with their goals, their objectives. In most of the towns is to preserve the rural atmosphere and the quality of that area, and the RMP standards would help them more than the use of the simply using the statewide 2 milligrams per liter standard. So I think in Somerset County itself, the five municipalities that are in the Highlands in Somerset County, I've heard that Far Hills wants to again increase its or decrease its density standard. In other words, make its density lower, go to 25-acre zoning in the area outside of the little village. And Bedminster is I believe, interested in possibly conforming to the Highlands Plan, or at least is certainly interested in preserving its rural character and having a low density of development to contrast with the high density of development in the hills. So I think within the towns that are part of the Somerset County area that the county is working on developing the wastewater management plans with, that these towns would be supportive of the council asserting its authority here and taking the actions that are within its power to require wherever it can or make strong recommendations wherever it can that all towns in the Highlands adhere to these the density standards in the RMP. So I hope that the council will not abrogate this opportunity to make the Highlands Plan be implemented in all the ways that it is possible to do so. And I think it will have very beneficial effects. Regarding the cluster provisions that were discussed today, my head is kind of spinning, but I have concerns about how I don't see anything in these in the language dealing with community character and the scenic impacts on the conservation zone. I mean, the farmland area is a very beautiful area, and I continue to fail to see how clustering houses will improve it in any way. Really, the development should be restricted to farm-associated development if the desire really is to protect the farmland and the farming. Development is just development, whether it's spread about or whether it's clustered. So, thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
A very brief, Peter Craig from Home Adventure, a very brief comment about cluster development, and particularly about clusters. I know that the basic notion here, the basic purpose is to preserve farmland. However, you have to recognize that while doing this, when you use the cluster mechanism, and particularly if you use a cluster of cluster mechanisms, you're doing something in addition to that. You're being involved in community design. But the way it's being done is that you are designing communities basically by inadvertence, because a whole different set of ideas have to come into play when you do community design. And I would suggest to you that the cluster provisions that you're working with may well produce an awful lot of places where people live that are very different than you think beforehand that they might be. Thank you.
Thank you.
I was just going to kind of respond to Helen's comment, you know, about the effort that it would take for a group of farmers to come up with a clustering plan and to see, is it possible that some of the grant money that we have could be used to provide some seed money for the farmers to do the analysis to see if they could develop a clustering option?
It's something we've contemplated through plan conformance in working with municipalities to do it, and that could assist the farmers. I don't think we've talked about giving it to private landowners, giving them grants. The grants were set aside for municipal and county conformance, but using it in that manner and getting to community design and those kind of issues, that's what we already have considered through the conformance process.
But we've approved grants for other farm-related activities, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they would go to some kind of farm protection entity?
County ag boards or whatever like that we have.
So could we do that? I mean, if we want to promote clustering, if we feel that this is a positive thing, mm-hmm. couldn't we make it available to them and then have them serve to help the farmers in an area?
Yeah, we could work through county ag boards. We could work through municipalities as well. I think it's important to keep both of those options open because it gets to what Mr. Craig was saying as well about community design and making sure that the town And we do talk a lot in the plan about the character of the communities and making sure that what we do fits the character of those communities. So there would be grant monies available if we just have to make sure that it's always, they go to the appropriate parties.
Okay. Just one comment on that. I just have to say, it seems like we should really be spending our money on preservation rather than development projects. I don't see how helping farmers develop their land is really a way that we should be.
I think it gets more to the whole planning process through conformance we would be giving monies to. And we would expect towns, if they're going to go through that planning analysis as well, to determine the future, to get away from that scattered piecemeal development, that they need to look at this, and it's a planning exercise.
I think community design, as it was mentioned by a member of the public, funding that kind of thing definitely is a fine idea. I'm just saying, to get farmers together to figure out how they can cluster, develop their farms, on the face of it, doesn't sound like what we should be funding.
Well, we did set forth a priority to look at preservation techniques first, clustering at the end. So we would be maintaining that, and then using also the tools, the innovative tools. That is our first goal.
Our first goal is to preserve the farming, exactly.
Our next meeting is 2 weeks from today, May 15th at 10 o'clock. Is there a motion to adjourn?
Move.
Second.